Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA-TV, SiriusXM Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. We'll be talking with Jim Garrity of National Review here momentarily. Michael Graham of the Boston Herald later this hour. Paul Bedard at Washington Examiner just tweeted out a portion of this new Pew survey that we'll be discussing this afternoon on gun ownership in the country. One in five gun owners, according to Pew, one in five gun owners belongs to the NRA. And that was Paul's headline. I said, were that it so, one in five Americans identify as, or one, excuse me, one in five gun owners identify as NRA members. Unfortunately, got a lot of people who identify as NRA members who maybe they think that their membership is active. Maybe they were, you know, a one-year membership and they didn't renew it, but they still think they're NRA members. Because that would be close to 20 million Americans. And look, the NRA is growing. Had a huge turnout at the NRA annual meeting in Atlanta this year. But I don't think we're at 20 million yet. If we were, oh, imagine all of the things that we could do with our voice and our votes. Raised 20 million strong. And we know, apparently, that there are 20 million Americans who at least believe that they're NRA members. So we've got our work to do as gun owners this weekend. We head out to the range. We do some plinking with some friends. Ask your friends, are you an NRA member? If they say, yeah, you say, you got your card? Look and see. Just look and see. You can give them this anecdote. Say, you know, NRA membership is about 5 million, but we've got 20 million Americans who say that they're NRA members. So I'm just doing a little spot check, just helping out here. Are you sure you're active? You might even look at your card, make sure that that you're active as well. But it's good to know that there are 20 million Americans who are on the same side, on the team, even if they're not suited up and actually in uniform. All right, Jim Garrity joins us from National Review on the program. Jim, how are you today?
Cam, doing good. Perhaps not as well as the NRA would be doing if 15 million people suddenly said, oh my goodness, my membership expired, and wrote the check, filled it out, you know, right now somewhere in the dues collection office, there's someone saying,
yeah, get ready for the inundation. You know, and it's interesting because the last time around I saw one of these surveys, I think it was something around 14 or 15 million Americans said that, that they belonged to the NRA, when the membership was closer to like 4 million. So,
great. That tells me 5 million non-paying members.
Right? Yeah. So there you go. Check the membership card. Check the membership card. Make sure that you're still active. And Jim, let's talk about, I know that the news cycle has very quickly moved on from these special elections earlier this week, but let's take a couple of minutes since you used to write the campaign spot at National Review. And this was something that you were paying very close attention to. The race in Georgia, the most expensive congressional race in history, the Democrat ends up losing a percentage of the vote compared to the primary and compared to Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, the race in South Carolina, which really nobody was paying any attention to, turnout way down compared, but more typical of a special election than what the turnout was in Georgia. Turnout was very high in Georgia. But that one was actually the closer race in South Carolina. Were you surprised by what happened on Tuesday night?
I was, but it was a good reminder of the sort of thing that can happen in special elections. You may know my folks don't live in the 5th district in South Carolina, but they're not too low from there. And, you know, still stay in touch. I have a bunch of readers out there, and a bunch of them are like, what really? You know, I knew Mulvaney retired. I hadn't really kind of, you know, there hadn't been inundated with TV ads and mailers and all the traditional stuff that happens when there's a congressional race going on. The turnout was actually less than 90,000, which is really low for a congressional race. Yeah, and this is what happens in a special election. And yes, nobody really thought it was going to be a particularly competitive race. Sometimes that happens, and as a result of that, Democrats, you know, yeah, they are fired up, and they did have slightly better than expected turnout. And the Republicans had kind of, you know, lower than expected turnout, in part because everybody thought they had it in the bag. This was a, I believe it was John Spratt had this seat until the 2010 midterm elections. Mick Mulvaney beat him. So it was not an overwhelmingly Republican, district, but because Mulvaney had won pretty comfortably every year since every cycle since 2010. And people tend to think of South Carolina as being a very Republican state. people didn't pay attention. You heard a bunch of Democrats saying, oh, you know, the stupid people at the DCCC and the DNC, those idiots, why didn't they understand they should have put more resources into this race in South Carolina? Well, look, the people at the DNC and DCCC, they might be idiots, but they're not idiots for this reason. In that if you had actually nationalized this race, if you had actually called more attention to it, then turnout would have been up. And in a generally Republican-leaning district, it would have benefited the Republican candidate. There are occasional circumstances where you end up with a much closer race than expected because nobody thinks it's going to be competitive. It's a little bit of a paradox there. But there are two great examples, and ironically, they both involve Ed Gillespie, the new Republican nominee for the governor of Virginia, the election will be later this year. Ed Gillespie, back in 2014, ran against Mark Warner, incumbent Democrat. Everybody expected Mark Warner to have this thing locked up, and Gillespie came within about a 1 percentage point, and nobody had that. Nobody expected that. The polls had Warner way ahead for a really long time, and it was basically the Gillespie campaign was actually perfectly fine with that. They actually, like, okay, look, our plan is to come on strong right at the end. We don't want him hampering us with attack ads. We don't want him trying to define us before this race can really get started. We want to, wait and wait and wait and then, bah, sneak. That's, I don't know if that's a literal sound effect of the campaign. But, that last weekend, I think it was Mark Warner had run and had said something indicating he disapproved of the name of the Redskins. And the Redskins were playing on Monday night, a week before Election Day, and they run an Ed Gillespie ad that basically the gist is, isn't this a stupid thing for your senator to be wasting his time on? And obviously there are a bunch of Redskins fans in Northern Virginia who are watching this. So all of a sudden, a bunch of people who may not even been paying attention, may not have even known that Mark Warner was up for your election that year. Mm-hmm. Hey, yeah, that really is the guy's saying my team nickname is wrong. And so he, Gillespie way overperformed what the polls were expecting. Then this year, everybody thought Ed Gillespie was going to win the primary in a slam dunk. He barely beat Corey Stewart in a very low turnout primary. And why was the turnout low? Well, because people didn't think this was going to be a particularly competitive race on the Republican side. And, there's some debate that a lot of Northern Virginia Republicans, people who live in Fairfax County where I live, the Republicans thought the gubernatorial primary wasn't competitive, and they may have had a preference on the Democratic side, so they voted in the Democratic primary. Virginia is one of those states where we don't have party registration, registered to vote by party. So, every primary you can vote whichever one you want. So the short version is yes, I was surprised by the closeness of that race, Cam.
That's the short version. Okay, so next question. You mentioned Ed Gillespie. And I'm glad that you did, because I want to talk now about Virginia, New Jersey. We've got off your election. So for the election addicts out there, this is going to be your next fix, right? I mean, you're going to have to pay attention to what's going on in New Jersey and Virginia. And one of the things that we saw on election night this week, and it's continued on the left, this divide now, right? Was John Ossoff too much of a squish? Was he too middle of the road? Was he too milquetoast? This is the guy who launched his campaign in the primary with a email entitled "Make Trump Furious," but when he got the nomination, stopped talking about Donald Trump. Right, so you had Sally Cohn say, "We got to quit running these centrist candidates on election night." You've had a couple members of Congress say, "Yeah, you know what? It's time for Nancy." But on the other hand, you've had people say, "Ah, it's time for Nancy Pelosi to go." Right, she's killing us in these districts because it's San Francisco liberal Nancy Pelosi. That's a really big split. And Virginia is a really interesting state because you've got Northern Virginia, Fairfax County, Alexandria, very deep blue, right? They're going to want Ralph Northam to be that progressive guy that he was running as in the primary. He and Tom Perriello were trying to out-progressify one another. Meanwhile, you get outside of Northern Virginia. You start getting around Fredericksburg and a point south with a couple of exceptions like Richmond, maybe Virginia Beach. It's a pretty conservative to moderate state, and there's not really interest in a Bernie Sanders style progressive. So how do you think the lessons of the special election in Georgia are going to play out here in Virginia? What do you think? Are we going to see this split within the Democrats emerge in this race, Jim, even though the primary's over?
I know it will shock you, Cam, that everybody walks away from this result saying, well, this proves I was right all along. I also want to call attention to an observation you had on election night, which I thought was a very sharp and astute one, when you notice people starting to refer to John Ossoff as this milquetoast moderate guy. Well, look, I talked to various Republicans, including Ralph Reed of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, who was obviously pulling for Karen Handel in this race. But he said, you know, about a week and a half before, he said, look, John Ossoff is not making it easy for us. John Ossoff, yes, he looks very, very young. Cam, you and I would not send him to buy beer if he didn't have his ID with him. Yes, he didn't live in the district, and, you know, you and I made fun of him a bit. You know, this became something of an issue as it went on. But by and large, he avoided gaffes. By and large, this was a guy who did not have had a decent resume, didn't have any scandals or skeletons in his closet or things like that from his past. He basically had been a pretty good candidate for this district, and who had basically done his best to tailor his message, and obviously, you know, was good enough to get him 48% both times. One other thing that I think is worth noting here is that traditionally in a House race, if you're a Democratic state legislator and you're running for Congress, what the Republican strategists on the other campaign will do is they will go through your record and try to count every single time you voted for a tax increase. Every time you voted in the General Assembly or state legislature, every time you voted in the committee, every time you voted in subcommittee, basically they go through the entire thing trying to find, okay, how many times can we say this guy voted for a tax? And sometimes they even, you know, some people might say this is cheating. If you vote against a tax cut, they count that as voting for increasing taxes. And some people say it's not really fair. But basically, they add it all up, and we've all seen this in a campaign of, you know, John Smith voted to raise taxes 487 times. And it becomes a very effective attack message. You know, this guy says he's a moderate, but look at his record. He really wants to tax the hell out of you, and that's why you can't vote for this guy. And this has worked for Republicans for a really long time. 2006, Democrats are trying to take back the House. The political winds are at their back. And in a lot of cases that year, Democrats ran either first-time candidates or they ran candidates who were not career politicians. Doctors, dentists, lawyers, Jim Webb, the former Secretary of the Navy, running here in Virginia. Heath Shuler, former professional quarterback, although I'm sure some Redskins fans are cringing when I say the term professional. But, you know, the idea of guys who didn't have this kind of record that you could attack easily. And John Ossoff did not have he's only 30 years old and had never been in government before. But you could say, you know, this guy voted to raise taxes these times, or he voted for this bill, or he voted for that bill. This was the strategy Democrats wanted to apply heading into 2018. To find candidates who did not have this easy to attack record, run in these districts of the suburbs where maybe it was traditionally Republican leaning, but they were not particularly pro-Trump. And this is where Georgia's 6th district was a really classic example of this. You probably heard the numbers. Tom Price won by 23 points, and most years he was winning easily and handily. Trump carried this district by about 1.5 points. That's not really much at all. So the perception was there are a lot of people who are traditional Republicans, generally fiscally conservatives, who are not comfortable with the entire Trump persona and the Trump agenda. The Democrats, we can win here. We can win over these Republican women. We can win over these moderate Republicans, and they will vote for Democrats, and that's how we'll build back our majority. Well, we can't say that plan is blown to pieces, but it took a shot on Tuesday night. It did not work. Now, 48% is nothing to sneeze at, but you know, next time she runs, Karen Handel will have all the advantages of incumbency. And all other things being equal, you'll expect that she'll have the advantage there. And oh, by the way, you add up all the numbers. At least according to the most recent numbers I had in the New York Times, I added up the spending of the campaigns and all of the outside spending. Cam, the Democrats had a $9 million advantage in this race, in a House district race. I mean, that's just unheard of. There are a lot of House races where you don't spend $9 million on both sides altogether. And this is for a short special election. You know, by the way, interesting theory floating around is that one of the reasons Ossoff lost was actually over-advertising. The people got so sick of his ads at every commercial break on every channel and every radio station that eventually they're like, just go away. I just want this election to be over. And people were putting up signs on their doors saying, please don't knock on my door. I already voted, or I'm not registered to vote.
I saw a couple of those signs on Twitter, and it was something like, you know, it was over $180 per vote, which is, you know, a fairly extraordinarily high amount per vote. I think the only other time that we've seen that, at least that I've seen that, the New York mayor's race, Bloomberg's third term after he changed the charter so he could run again, he ended up spending, I think it was $180 million or $180 per vote. But that was a mayor's race, right? I mean, that was still a staggering amount of money for a New York mayor's race.
Cam, right now Bloomberg is saying that's a bargain. Only $180
Yeah, right.
You get them wholesale?
Well, listen. Listen, I'm sure that Bloomberg is going to be playing very heavily in Virginia this year with the governor's race. And I think that, you know, again, gun control is going to be one of those issues where I've been seeing, looking through, you know, like Reddit and looking at some of the Democrat message boards over the past couple of days. And, Jim, gun control is one of those issues where I don't know how big a number of Democrats it is, but it's a fairly vocal number of Democrats saying, stop with the gun control. Stop it. It's killing us out here in the heartland. This Pew survey that came out today showed that about a third of self-described Democrats are gun owners and either believe the NRA has enough power or not enough political power right now. Now, that's, you know, again, it's a minority of the Democrat Party, but it's a pretty good chunk of the party. And can you alienate if you're trying to build, if you're the Democrats and you're trying to build your coalition right now, how badly do you want to alienate a third of your self-described supporters?
My boss and colleague Rich Lowry wrote in Politico today, and he kind of asked, well, how seriously do Democrats want to beat Trump? Because they'd probably say, I'm willing to do anything. You know, this is our highest priority. We got to win back the majority. But apparently they're not willing to let people let their own members go their own way on the abortion issue and go their own way on the gun issue. There was this infamous fight over Bernie Sanders endorsing this guy running for mayor of I believe it was Omaha, and he was not even like what most pro-lifers would consider to be pro-life. He merely had expressed some deviations from the orthodoxy of the pro-choice movement. And as a result of that, there are people saying, how dare the DNC support this guy? This is exactly what we need to stand up against, et cetera. Otherwise, this guy is a down-the-line, you know, Democrat. And I think that's very similar on the gun issue. You don't see a lot of, let's say, outspoken pro-Second Amendment Democrats. And it wasn't that long ago, Cam. I remember going to some of those NRA conventions in places like Charlotte and seeing the Keith Schulers of the world invited as speakers and things like that. There was once a, you know, not a large, but a distinctive pro-gun, for lack of a better term, chunk of the Democratic Party. I think Jim Webb would have fit in that category pretty clearly. And they just, you know, the Democrats one by one have driven them out of there. And it's very interesting that, you know, no matter how much they lose on this issue, they really don't want to give ground on it. And so, look, you know, you and I had talked in the past. Donald Trump did not head into the Republican primary with a sterling record on gun issues. And there are times he had said things in the past that indicated he supported some forms of gun control. And then he became a Republican candidate, and he saw the light, so to speak. And all of a sudden he came out and he was very clear in all of his remarks and also completely understood the importance of judges to the Second Amendment community. And how much they knew the Heller decision had been decided by one vote, and thus the Supreme Court was an extremely important issue to these voters. And by and large, I was going to say this knocking on wood next to me somewhere, you know, he's been pretty darn good on this issue. And so the interesting thing is we didn't see anything on the other side. In other words, Trump realized this was something that was very important to winning both the nomination and to winning the country as a whole. But Democrats just they aren't willing to give up on this. And I suppose you could, you know, from one light, this is them sticking by a principled position. They think that ultimately the Second Amendment is a bad part of the Constitution, that it should be rescinded, and they oppose private gun ownership, or many of them, if not the entire party do. Then this is, you know, they keep saying we want sensible restrictions, like the one in Australia, which was mass confiscation. And they, you know, and they won't give up on that. And so that's fine, guys. You can hold that position. You're just going to lose a lot of races that you think you should be winning in the race. And I think that was that's the real kind of aftershock of the Georgia special election, was that Democrats really thought they had a chance to win this. And based on the, you know, the first round of voting and the enormous financial advantage they had and their perception that the country is just burgeoning and full of anti-Trump sentiment. Now we got to ask, you know, is it enough to get you to 48%? you know, that's nice. It's better than usual, but it's not going to get you the seat, and that's kind of what, you know, the ball game is about.
It's, believing is believing, Jim, as Alyssa Milano said on election night. Believing is believing. So maybe that'll be the slogan heading into 2018.
Back check.
And, you know, it's interesting. I know we're running out of time, but specifically on the gun issue, I think the split for the Democrats on the gun issue, well, there are a couple. You've got, A, some pro-gun Democrats who say just drop this entirely, right? But then there's that whole messaging fight right now. I don't know if you saw this a couple of weeks ago. Elizabeth Esty, congresswoman from Connecticut, was at an event. I think it was the Center for American Progress. And she said, don't say gun control. Don't say it. Because if you say gun control, you immediately lose 15% of male voters. So say gun safety. Talking about the same politics, the same, you know, policies, but just call it something different. There's a big movement right now, I think, of the anti-gun groups to try to build up this narrative of well, we're reasonable, right? We're not anti-gun. We love the Second Amendment. We love concealed carry. We're just in favor of a few common sense gun safety laws. And I don't think it's true, Jim. And I think that for a lot of American voters, they don't think it's true. It's not believable. And for the really progressive voters out there, they view it as an insult because they're saying, no, you need to be bold. You need to be talking about what you really want to do. You know, we had that front page editorial in the New York Times a couple of years ago talking about banning all kinds of commonly owned farms. And we're going to have to go take them from people. That's what we need to be talking about. That's what they want to hear, not this mealy mouth talk about common sense gun laws. And the people that they're trying to reach out to don't believe it because it's the same crowd that's been talking. They clearly haven't changed their mind. It's clearly a narrative that they're trying to build as opposed to something they really believe, because they've never found a gun law that they actually support. They've never come out in favor of anything that's in support of the Second Amendment. It's always, the gun law. It's just a repackaging under the guise of gun safety. And I think that's something that the Democrats are really going to have to deal with, too.
You know, Cam, for a really long time, I used the quote-unquote gun show loophole as a very useful measuring stick of how serious someone was talking about an issue, because they would say, oh, God, look at something awful like the Virginia Tech shooting. We have to do something about this. We have to stop. We have to close the gun show loophole. And I'd ask them, did the shooter get his guns at a gun show? And some of them would stare back blankly. Some would insist yes, even though he had it. And then some would say, well, no, but, you know, and they would have a very tough time connecting the legislative remedies that they had to the types of awful gun shootings and things that they tragedies that they wanted to prevent. And you'd kind of push them on this, and you'd kind of say, well, like, okay, like, so if your law would change, if this change in the law you're calling for wouldn't have changed anything, what is the purpose other than to, like, to harangue, you know, it really is to make you feel good, is kind of our sneaking suspicion of this, that you know it's not going to work, or you don't care that it's not going to work, you just want to look responsive. And your idea is that, well, guns are bad, and so if we can find any way to restrict gun sales at all, then we've made the world a better place. And I think if you're thinking that abstractly, and you don't care that you're going to punish law-abiding gun owners, then I think deep down, really, it's about punishing people. It's all about emotion. It's not about actually what leads to these sorts of things. We're coming up on time. Let's just say that, I think I'd say debate, I'm going to use air quotes as I say that because I don't think it really counts as a debate. The exchange between my colleague Charlie Cook and my former colleague David Frum, who I'm just extraordinarily – David Frum and I have had pleasant conversations in the past. And on this issue, he is just completely off his rocker. And not just that, really snide and obnoxious and disrespectful in the way he interacts with other people. He goes straight to name calling on this, and it is – I sent a message to Frum a little while saying I thought you were better than this. I haven't gotten a reply, so apparently it wasn't.
Well, we still love you, Jim.
Thank you.
It's okay. I don't think you're gonna miss that relationship too much, buddy. all right, listen, have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you again very soon. Jim Garrity from National Review here. We're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, we're going to talk more about that Pew poll that came out earlier today on American gun ownership. I've got some questions, honestly, about some of the numbers. It's Well, we'll get into it after a quick timeout. Also, later in the hour, Michael Graham of the Boston Herald talking about the Georgia 6th. You know, Michael, a former resident of that district, and so we'll get his thoughts. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company still to come right after this. Talking with Ron Sasaki from AmericanSnipers.org. In case people haven't ever heard of AmericanSnipers.org, what is the mission of this group?
Okay, what our mission is we help equip our military snipers. If they have any equipment needs when they're getting deployed, if they can't get equipment through their normal chain of command, they get a hold of us, and we gift that gear to them. No cost to them. We operate solely on donations. We're 100% nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. So we're just trying to help these guys out as they're going downrange.
And this is really, I think, a brotherhood that got started here. I mean, you've got a law enforcement, military members who were instrumental, I mean, in putting this together. This started with one guy helping one guy, and it kind of snowballed from there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started, most of us have a law enforcement background. We're all current or former SWAT snipers. So in the early 2000s, we had some of our brother snipers getting deployed in various units, and they found out there was an equipment shortage at that time. So they asked for some gear, and it got donated, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So we've been going strong ever since. You know, kind of slowed down with the units getting deployed over the last few years, but of course things are starting to ramp back up again.
Absolutely. And you know, you talk about the slowdown, but it never really disappears because, you know, a lot of these guys are they're kind of operating in the shadows. They're not operating in the theaters where we see a lot of headlines about combat. Some of these missions are taking place in places where we don't necessarily even think about guys being on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it hasn't been on the headlines, people kind of forget about them. And then, you know, so their budgets shrink, too. So we are still supporting some of those guys, even some of the, you know, the bigger units that are doing a lot of work overseas. So we've got a lot of equipment that's been going out. So, you know, all the donations and being able to be here at the NRA show has been great. That really helps out a lot.
That's fantastic. And just give me an example of like some of the type of equipment that you will provide these guys. What are they not getting?
Well, it's mostly sniper-specific equipment that we provide. So it's a lot of binoculars, rangefinders, spotting scopes, the Kestrel wind meters, a lot of those things that the guys ask for that they have a tough time getting through their normal chain of command. We operate solely on donations. So if you can go to AmericanSnipers.org, you can donate there, or you can buy some of our T-shirts and hats and challenge coins, and that's what helps us out.
This is called a Queen Anne's pistol. It is a single-shot flintlock muzzle loader that was commonly used through Great Britain during the reign of Queen Anne. They were very popular, and she reigned from the end of the 1600s to about 1716, I think.
It's beautiful.
Very beautiful gun. It's quite aesthetically pleasing. It's got an interesting feature. The gun is a screw barrel. There's no ramrod here at all. You just take this barrel off, and you pour your bullet down first and your powder behind it, and you can reload it just by doing that. And yeah, pretty cool.
And how well did you weren't bound around, but theoretically, how well does that work? I mean, with the thread, it's safe, right?
It's safe. Yeah. It's bound to gum up over a period of time because of the black powder fouling. Right. And personally, I'd rather have a ramrod. I don't need to unscrew and screw on the barrel every time I want to make it go bang. It looks pretty cool, though. It's got a raised lip here, which makes it look like a cannon muzzle.
I was going to say, especially when you take the barrel off, it looks like the barrel of a cannon.
Yeah. And the lock is actually part of the receiver instead of being separate, where it attaches to the receiver. The receiver is the lock, and a beautiful walnut grip, and nice escutcheons. You've got silver little treatments here. This one's got a London proof mark, and was made by Wilson. We have a couple of Wilson-made guns in the collection here. And this is a delightful little piece.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Mr. Michael Graham joins us in a few minutes, talking about Georgia 6th. Also, next hour, We're going to talk with the president of Machine Gun America outside of Orlando, Florida, Mark Adler. They are offering a free firearm safety course for members of the LGBT community. They did this last weekend. They're doing it again this weekend. And so we'll talk to them about the turnout last weekend, what they're looking for this weekend, and what the response in the community has been. Tim Graham of the Media Research Center coming up next hour as well. A new survey out says most Americans agree that the media is biased in one way or another. We don't all agree on how the media is biased, but most of us agree that the media is, in fact, biased. This is something that Tim Graham and the folks at the Media Research Center have been talking about for decades now. So now that Americans agree with Tim, where do we go from here? And another survey released today by Pew Research on gun ownership in this country. And I have some questions. I every poll I say this, take it with as many grains of salt as you want. And I'm taking this one with some grains of salt. So according to Pew, the percentage of adults saying that they currently own a gun, 30%, 42%. When you include people who don't currently own a gun, but they live with someone who does. So 42% of Americans either currently own a gun or they live in a household where somebody owns a gun. 57% say they live in a household where there are no firearms. Few individuals declined to answer this. So 30% of the population in the United States, we do a gun ownership in this country somewhere around 90 to 100 million Americans. And that's about 30% of the population. So I can kind of buy that. This was a survey, by the way, of 3,930 adults, including 1,269 gun owners. So, again, keep in mind, we know that there are tens of millions of gun owners out there. They talk to less than 1,300. But let's take a look at the poll as it is. Percentage of gun owners, they asked, why do you own a gun? 67% said for self-defense. 38%, you could answer more than one. 38% said for hunting. 30% said for sport shooting. 13% said as part of a gun collection. 8% said for their job. So two-thirds of the gun owners surveyed said self-defense, the primary reason why I own a firearm. That also doesn't strike me as unreasonable. That holds true, by the way, for male and female gun owners that were surveyed by Pew. 65% of men, 71% of women say that they primarily own a firearm for self-defense. Two-thirds of gun owners say that they own more than one firearm. Roughly 29% say that they personally have five or more firearms. That also doesn't strike me as unusual. Many gun owners say that they usually have a gun close at hand. About 4 in 10 gun owners, 38%, say that there's a gun that's both loaded and easily accessible to them all of the time when they're at home. And about a quarter of handgun owners, 26%, say that they carry a gun outside of their home all or most of the time. Among handgun owners who live in a community that they think is unsafe, the share who carry all or most of the time rises to 41%. Now let's talk about that. The specific numbers, again, I'm a little curious about because, you know, Dr. Lott has said right now we're looking at about 15 million concealed carry holders. So if we're looking at a baseline of 90 to 100 million gun owners in this country, and a quarter of them say that they carry most or all of the time, it's going to be more than 15 million. Even if you take into account constitutional carry states, I think there might be some people saying that they carry most or all of the time. They may even have their concealed carry license, but I don't know that they are. But I do think it's interesting, regardless of how specifically accurate these numbers are, there is something I think we can learn from this. So about a quarter of all gun owners, according to the survey, say they carry a gun for self-defense pretty much all the time. That number, though, rises. 41% of those gun owners who live in a place that they think is unsafe, they're carrying a firearm all the time. We don't know why they're not. And I wish that Pew had asked this survey. I wish Pew had asked an additional question. Are you allowed to carry? Because, again, if you live in Baltimore, Maryland, you can't. You may very well live in an unsafe neighborhood, and you can't carry. If you live in New York City, you can't carry. If you live in Los Angeles or San Francisco or pretty much anywhere in coastal California, you can't carry. If you live in Camden, New Jersey or Washington, D.C., you can't carry. So I would have loved to have seen that question, that one additional question, and maybe two additional questions. One, are you allowed to carry? Two, if you were allowed to carry, would you? Because, again, we know that there are millions, according to this Pew survey, there are millions of Americans who are carrying concealed right now. But we also know, just because of the laws that are on the books, that there are millions more Americans, tens of millions of Americans, who are deprived of their ability to carry a firearm for self-defense. All right, we're going to go through more of the survey results. This is a pretty beefy survey, so we'll be talking about it throughout the afternoon. We are going to step away for just a moment or two, though. When we come back, Michael Graham, columnist with the Boston Herald, is going to join us. Now, Michael used to live down in Georgia in the 6th Congressional District, so he knows a thing or two about that special election that took place earlier this week. We'll get his thoughts right after a quick timeout. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim. I'd love to talk about Refuse to Be a Victim. It's a great program. Let's start with what is Refuse to Be a Victim and why does NRA do it?
So Refuse to Be a Victim was actually founded in 1993 by women. They were a request from them nationwide for crime prevention seminars. So that's why it was initially created. And then in 97, it became co-ed. Essentially, it's a program that teaches methods to improve personal safety strategies by increasing awareness, avoiding dangerous situations, and preventing criminal confrontations.
And this has been a very popular program for the NRA, and you even mentioned that it was, first was women, and then enough of the guys said, hey, NRA, we want this information too, so it became co-ed. So why do you think it's so popular?
I think it just has a lot to offer. It's one of the few programs that the NRA does offer that doesn't really push firearms, and not everyone in the country is comfortable with that. And I think that outcry originally came from women, so it kind of gave them a whole other option of how to protect themselves if they weren't if they're not comfortable carrying around a firearm to protect themselves, which is why I think it's such a popular program across the country for everyone.
Speaking with Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program. Mina, tell us some of the aspects of the program. What is it you guys do?
So we have over 8,000 instructors across the country that conduct different seminars. The seminars are about 4 hours long in length, where they go over all the different types of strategies that help you not be a victim of crime. So that's a big thing of what we do.
So the seminars are big. And what do you cover? What are some of the topics that you cover?
Sure. So some topics that we cover are going to be home security, travel security, different like physical security, so things that you can possibly carry on your person, and go over different risk factors of each one, so kind of like the pros and cons and what would be best for you. We also go a little bit into cybersecurity as well.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. So we got home security, physical security, travel, and cyber, among other things. So let's quickly touch on a couple of those. Just give me some highlights of home security. What do we need to look out for?
So for home security, you're going to want to make sure that your house is properly locked, so it's secure. You want to make sure that your deadbolts are working. If you don't have any, go get some. You have proper lighting, so you can. That kind of defers people from coming into your home so it looks like someone is there. So those are some of the big things to cover in home security.
How about when we travel? It's summertime. A lot of folks are traveling. What are some of the highlights from travel security?
Again, kind of going back to some of the things that we hit on in home security, you want to make sure it looks like someone is there and someone's home. You don't want to make it look like you're traveling and no one's there, because that makes you just look like an easy target.
Right. So what you say, like when you're in a hotel room or something like that.
Yeah, so okay. If you're in a hotel, you want to make sure you have all your items locked away in a safe, because, you know, there are people who do have access to come into your room, so that's something we touch on as well.
All right. And finally, what about cybersecurity? That's a big one.
Yeah, cybersecurity is huge, and it is ever-changing. That is one that we are continuously updating and posting things on the NRA blog about. So for that, we want to encourage people to make sure they don't have an easy password and they are changing it often, and also just being aware of where you are logging into things and when you're not, and also being aware of what kind of apps you're downloading and where you're actually when you're clicking on links, just being sure of where you're going to on those.
So what you're saying, your password shouldn't be password. Is that what you're saying?
They should be very secure. You should think about something that no one else will guess.
Very good. Speaking of Mina Clear with NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program. All right, got a little more time. Let's touch on one more. How about physical security? That's a big one.
Yeah, physical security is huge. So we actually have a display table at each seminar that the instructor compiles for themselves. And it has different tactics that you can use to protect yourself. So some of the things we have out there are so tasers, stun guns, personal alarms. So wow. Carrying those things around with you and kind of discussing the pros and cons of each one of perfect. Why it could be a good fit for you.
I'm sorry, before we run out of time, how do we get more information about NRA's Refuse to Be a Victim program?
Yep. You can contact us at refuse@nrahq.org or give us a call at 800-861-1166.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. I just spent the last commercial break doing math. I was told there would be no math with this job, but I'm curious about the Pew Research numbers, so I've been digging in a little bit deeper, and we'll talk a little bit more about that at the top of the hour. Michael Graham, columnist for the Boston Herald, is with us on the program right now on Twitter at @IamMGraham. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing great. I'm on my balcony here in beautiful Vienna, Virginia, enjoying the weather. And then, of course, as soon as I start talking to you, I see helicopters circling. You're never going to find me. You're never going to take me, coppers. So I hope the helicopter stays away long enough for us to do this.
I hope so as well. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. And we were talking a little bit earlier in the show with Jim Garrity of National Review about the special election in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. But as a former resident of that district, and somebody who I know you were following this race very closely, very curious to get your take. I mean, we were told this was going to be a close race, neck and neck. And then at the end, you saw this surge for Karen Handel. I think, what was it? There was one pollster that actually kind of picked up on this and had right. Handel winning in their last poll, but not by the margin that she did. Were you surprised by what you saw on Tuesday?
Well, no, actually, I wrote a column that came out Tuesday morning predicting a narrow Handel win, not because of any magic of Karen Handel. She's not what you call a sparkling candidate. She doesn't really jazz up the crowd. It's kind of like your, you know, elementary school librarian running for office. And not because of Ossoff or any problems that he had. He wasn't a great candidate, but he wasn't a terrible candidate. It was because Republicans vote Republican. And even in the era of Trump, Republicans have settled down, embrace their inner Republican. They're sticking with their party, and that means sticking with Trump to a degree. And it's interesting. I'd like to run this idea by you, Cam. My argument would be right now that the parties themselves have never been weaker. The Democrats are so weak they had to cheat to keep a socialist from getting the nominee from their choice, Hillary Clinton. And the Republicans are so weak they couldn't stop a Democrat, Donald Trump, from becoming the nominee in the first place. So the parties themselves are weak, but party affiliation has rarely been stronger. Party affiliation now is, according to one study I saw, a better predictor of your behavior than your sex or your age or your ethnicity. And that's I used to run campaigns for a living. That's a first.
Okay, so help me factor in the fact that we've got a growing number of Americans who don't claim any party identification.
Mm-hmm.
Does that contribute to the weakening of the party? I mean, as you're saying, the people who are identifying with the party are doing so very strongly, right? And they're there, right? But then you've also got that pretty large number of uncommitted Americans. Does that contribute to the weak state of the political parties?
Well, if you ask smart people like Jim Garrity, and I'm sure you will, or pollsters like Kristen Soltis Anderson, they will tell you that that's a dodge by the voters. The voters say they're unaffiliated in some states. They say they're independent in some states. But if you watch how they vote Democrat or Republican almost every time. The number of actual swing voters, the voters who are willing to, you know, electorally speaking, throw their keys in the bowl and shake them around and take what comes out, is small and getting smaller. Republicans in a Republican district, Georgia 6th, came home. I think it's the same if you look at issues like the health care issue. If you ask people separate from party affiliation, what do you think of the idea of, for example, letting insurance companies have more power to sell across state lines and compete with each other so your health care bills would look more like your car insurance bills where there's, you know, competition drives the price down? People will tell you, I think that's a great idea. Then you stick the word Republican or Democrat with that idea, and the polling completely changes. And that's what you're seeing with the Senate health care bill coming out today.
You think that a part of the reaction is simply because it's coming from the Republican Senate?
Oh, of course. Dude, I mean, by the way, Cam, I know that you're not quite as old as I am, but can you remember way back when we were being told that over-the-top, heated, violent rhetoric was bad for America? What was that? Thursday, right? Yeah, I think it was Thursday.
Yeah.
And now here we are one week later. Have you seen your Twitter feed this morning with the Senate bill? Republican plan will kill more people. That's an actual headline from Daily Kos. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. This is going to be a literal death sentence to people. You know, Elizabeth Warren, people are going to die. Boy, I'm glad we got past all that hateful, heated rhetoric, aren't you?
You know, and let's talk about that for a second. Can we please, Michael? Because, again, like the conversations that I have here in Farmville, Virginia with people, they don't play out the way they play out on talk radio or in the well of the Senate or on cable news. You know, they're talking about this very, very differently. They think Obamacare sucks. They're paying more for their health care. In many cases, they may have lost their doctor. And then they're hearing about the Republican plan and like, well, you know, I don't know. I don't even know what's in it. Right. So right. I don't know. But the gist of everybody seems to agree health care is a huge issue in this country. And both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, seem to be trying to score political points while it just gets worse. Democrats talk about people going to be dying with their health care. Today, the news, you've got more insurance companies pulling out of the markets in a lot of these states. The USA Today ran an editorial this week, single payer, we can't pay for it. You can't do it, right? In California, they're looking at trying to do it, $400 billion. That's twice the state's current budget right now. And they don't have enough money to pay for their current budget. Right. So it seems like we're talking past the real problem here, right? Which is that we've got people who are unhappy with healthcare. We don't have a lot of money to go single payer, despite the fantasy fever swamp dreams of people to say, well, that's the only option. It's not going to work. It's going to bankrupt this country in very short order. When do we get to have the serious, like, actual conversation about healthcare? I feel like a kid, Michael, who, like, for years, his parents have been saying, oh, we're going to go to Disney World. We're going to go to Disney World. We're going to go to Disney World. And then, like, the weekend that it comes, we don't have the money to go. Right? Like,
yeah, we're actually,
quit it. Just be honest with us. Just be honest with us. We all know we're hosed. We all know that this system is screwed up. We know it. Quit trying to shove sunshine and roses up our rear ends. Just level with us.
It's actually worse than that. It's not that you're not going to Disney World. They take you to like some lame-o petting zoo with one of those kid roller coasters that only goes 2 feet off the ground. And they try to tell you the size of it. Because listen, Republicans play a part in this too. Republicans, particularly President Trump, are lying about this notion that you can have some system that's just cheaper and better. And magically, it'll just be there. And no one will have to make any sacrifices. No one will have to change their opinion. No. Listen, free market means you deregulate. Free market means you let people make their own choices, and that means that some people are going to make bad choices. Free market means that you spend less money on the system overall because you're going to get more efficiency. In other words, think about what your cell phone cost, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It cost a lot more and it did a lot less. So if you announced today, you know, if you said 10 years ago, my cell phone bill is going to be $50 a month, in 2017, they'd go, oh my gosh, you're going to slash cell phone spending by 2/3. No, you can get an all you need plan for $50 now. But that's because of the free market. Republicans won't defend the free market. They won't put the cost restraints in the terms of free market. And they won't say, you know what? We believe in freedom. And that means some people are going to be free to do dumb things. They instead say that we need a plan that has, quote, heart. Well, when President Trump means heart, what he means is we spend lots of money so that dumb people get free money for their bad decisions.
And again, I understand the impulse, and you're right, it plays out across party lines. This is, and it's nothing new, by the way. This is not like this is a new phenomena, right? I mean, this is, a long time. It's not even just the United States. For thousands of years, rulers have been appealing to, you know, the people and saying, we're going to make your life better and we can do things. We can. All I ask is that we just have a little bit of honesty right now, because you look at what's going on around the country. I think we're running out of time, Michael. I don't think we can keep deceiving ourselves about the cost of these programs. You look at Illinois right now. Illinois doesn't have a budget. If they don't come up with a budget by the end of the month, they're not going to have enough money. 100% of their revenue is going to be towards debt services. They're not going to be able to run the lottery in Illinois because they won't have the money. That's one right. state. We mentioned California as well. There are so many issues, so many financial issues that we've been kicking down the road, and they're coming. And I realize it's a very tough thing for a politician to actually say, I'm going to have to scare the hell out of you because I got to level with you. No politician wants to do that. No one wants to be the one to be the deliverer of bad news if you're a politician. But we need some straight talk, I think, from our elected officials.
This is why I disagree. I agree with you that we need it, but I see no indication that the American populace is prepared for it. I mean, look at the two choices. The fact is you have the Bernie Sanders party, which is take stuff mm-hmm. from rich people and give it to other people. And you have the Donald Trump party, which is take stuff from foreign companies, corporations, I don't know, the Illuminati, I don't know, and give it to somebody. They're both in the let's give stuff away business. Where is the voice for individual responsibility? Where's the voice for it? It's your job to be an adult, to clothe, feed, and house and insure yourself. That voice just isn't there, and I don't know that there's a viable political movement for it. That's why you and I need to do a better job of getting people to connect the dumb decisions they made, like supporting Obamacare, with the horrifying outcomes, which it has been a horrifying outcome, but it's too easy to lie. Speaking of lying, by the way, what do you think of Trump acknowledging today what we all knew, that he did not have tapes of James Comey in their secret lunch meetings or whatever?
You know, I saw the news right before I went on the air. I didn't even have a chance to really read the tweet. Was it with all the recently reported electronic surveillance, intercepts, right. unmasking, and illegal leaking of information? I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversation with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. You know, I have to say I'm kind of chuckling a little bit, Michael. I get the trolling of the media that Donald Trump does. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is something that no president in history has ever done. It is something that yep. I'm absolutely sure many members of the DC media find very unpresidential. But this is something that I think a lot of Americans, they don't mind the media being trolled. And so I don't know. I kind of got a chuckle out of it. It's not going to be my outrage of the day.
I don't think sane people ever took to me. Donald Trump saying I taped the conversation is like Bill Clinton saying I did not have sex with that woman. I mean, we all knew it was a lie the first time we heard it, and watching the media pretend to take it serious was just hilarious. So he just threw it right back in their faces. So all entertainment,
yeah, absolutely.
All the time. Trump is an amazing, visceral, political creature. Ideology he doesn't do, policy doesn't do, but man, is he good at reading the room, if you will, getting the sense of where his team on the field are, what they want to hear, and owning his opposition, at least in the media cycle. It's just, it's hilarious to watch. I'm not a big fan of his, but wow, you got to admit, he is good at being Trump.
He definitely is. And so far, I got to say, we've seen some good stuff, I think, from the president when it comes to the Second Amendment. I hope we get a chance to see more of it. We've got the Supreme Court meeting today. Last time that the Supreme Court's going to meet for the spring term, Michael, and who knows, maybe by the fall term, maybe we'll be talking about another opening. Maybe we'll be having confirmation hearings before the Supreme Court gets back in the fall. There's all those rumors and speculation.
I predict it. Take the money. Take the line. Go to Vegas. We are going to have a new Supreme Court member. I guarantee you.
All right. Michael Graham, you heard it here first. Michael, thank you as always, sir. Glad the helicopter stayed away, but we'll let you get back to it.
I got to go. I'm having drinks at Shelley's back porch in D.C. with some inside the Beltway conservatives. So I got a cold Bushmills and a cigar waiting for me. I got to run.
All right. We will see you soon. Michael Graham joining us, columnist for the Boston Herald here on Cam and Company. Good for him. I'm sure it's a that's probably still pretty actually gross and muggy. I don't think I'd be outside today in D.C. All right, coming up top of the hour, again, we're going to get back to the Pew Research survey of gun owners in this country. You do the math, and it's kind of interesting, the figures that you come up with. Mark Adler from Machine Gun America in Florida is going to join us on the program next hour, a range offering a free firearm safety course for members of the LGBT community. They actually did this last year. last week. They're going to do it again this weekend. Tim Graham of the Media Research Center joins us as well in Hour 2. And then in Hour 3, Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner talking about this Pew poll. Kurt Schlichter of Town Hall joining us in Hour 3 as well. We've got more of the day's top stories. And an interesting column as well by Jay Ambrose. Gun control is fine, he says, except for the fact that it's not working. What's fascinating about this is I've actually seen this column run in places like the San Jose Mercury News. In the Bay Area of California. He says, whenever there's a shooting, liberals have the answer that is not an answer, namely the charade of more gun control. Fine, he says, try it. Maybe some voodoo along the way, but it doesn't work very well. There are better alternatives. And what is truly absurd in this debate, he says, is the demeaning expression gun nuts. He says, what about gun control nuts? All right, well, stick around. We'll be talking about that as well. Much more Cam and Company on the way. Hour 2, right after a quick timeout. So stick around. We'll be right back.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum, and you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so big and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why I say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finished second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded 3 of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for whatever you say.
I had to put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And, when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we were able to go up that hill. I get to do a burnout on the way up. know, all the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. A lot of these fans here in Bristol, they were cheering loud over there. The front stretch is burning it down. Hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
Watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It starts right this second. Mark Adler with Machine Gun America down in Kissimmee, Florida, going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. They are hosting a gun safety course this weekend. Held one last weekend as well, free of charge. To members of the LGBT community there in the Orlando area, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center going to join us later in the hour as well. And we've been talking about this Pew Research, a poll on gun ownership in the country. And even though I'm not great at math, I did some math over the last couple of breaks to try to actually get a sense of the numbers. They do this in percentage, right? They say the people that they talked to and they interviewed, they said 3,930 U.S. adults, 1,269 gun owners. They found 30% of the people that they surveyed currently own a gun, 42% live in a household with a gun. So there are 11% that say they don't currently own a gun, but they live with somebody who does. 57% say they live in a household with no gun. So now they interviewed adults. So I went back and I actually looked at the census data. Census says about 22% of the current population of 323 million or so is under the age of 18. You get rid of that, you come up with about 252 million. So 30% of the total number of adults in the United States would be 75.6 million gun owners, which is about 15 to 25 million less than the estimates that I've seen in the past. Just keep that in mind. We talked about 26% of those individuals that they surveyed, those gun owners that they surveyed, said that they are carrying a gun outside of their home all or most of the time. That would be about 19.6 million Americans. Now, John Lott has estimated the number of concealed carry licenses in the United States right now at about 15 million. You've got 12 states that are constitutional carry. That, again, that I think that there are some folks there who are gun owners, maybe even have a concealed carry license, but who are not carrying all the time, who are saying that they're carrying all the time. And I think that because that's their intent, that's their desire, that maybe that's where they want to get to, a place where they feel comfortable carrying all of the time. 41%, again, of the gun owners who live in neighborhoods that they think is unsafe say that they carry most or all of the time. One in five gun owners, according to this survey, say that they are NRA members. Now, if the number of gun owners is accurate, 75.6 million or so, that would be about 15 million Americans identifying as NRA members, which would be in line with previous surveys that we've seen in the past. But again, I think this survey may underestimate the number of American gun owners. I think that there are probably some folks who are gun owners who did not answer that they were gun owners on this survey. But again, 15 million people, even on the low end, 15 million Americans identify as NRA members. They may think that they're NRA members. They may have had a membership for a year or two and they let it lapse, but they identify with the NRA. And I think that's really important, particularly as we head into the elections next year. And I said this last hour, I'll say it again, and I've seen some folks on Twitter talk about this, and I've been retweeting at Cam Edwards. Just make sure. In fact, I had a guy say, you know what? I just checked. I need to renew my membership. Good. Good. Do that. You don't have to be a pest about it, but you can talk about this with your friends and your fellow gun owners. You can say, hey, I heard on Cam and Company the other day. There are 15 million Americans who say that they belong to the NRA, but there aren't 15 million NRA members. Wouldn't it be awesome if we actually did have 15 million NRA members? When your guys say, yeah, I'm an NRA member. Can I see your card? Are you sure? Because, you know, again, I think there are a lot of, Cam was saying, there are a lot of people that just forget to renew. Don't be a nudge. But bring up the idea. Because I think that again, we've got a lot of gun owners who are allies out there. Maybe some of them truly do, you know, they're not willing to plunk down the $25 a year, but they want to try to say that they're an NRA member. I don't think there are a lot of folks out there that are like that. I don't think there are a lot of folks who there's a firearms instructor, Mark in Ohio, who calls those folks freeloaders. Says if you're a gun owner and you're active, but you're not an NRA member, you're freeloading off of the work of other gun owners. I don't know how many quote unquote freeloaders there are out there, but I think that there are a lot of people who may still believe that they are in the NRA and just need that gentle reminder. All right, so the Pew survey. Well, again, we'll talk about this periodically throughout the afternoon. Gun owners and non-gun owners, Pew says, disagree on the impact that the ease of access to legal guns has on gun violence. So they asked what contributes either a great deal or a fair amount to gun violence in the country today. Number one answer for both gun owners and non-gun owners, the ease with which people can illegally obtain guns. 83% of gun owners agreed, 87% of non-gun owners agreed. Family instability, 77% of non-gun owners agreed with that, 66% of gun owners agreed. Lack of economic opportunity, 68% of non-gun owners said, yep, it's a great deal, fair amount contributed to the gun violence in the country. 59% of gun owners agreed. The ease with which people can legally obtain firearms, 67% of non-gun owners, 44% of gun owners. The non-gun owners, the people who've never bought a gun in this country, say it's way too easy to legally buy one. Meanwhile, the people who have legally purchased a firearm in this country say, no, that's not a major contributor to violent crime in this country. The amount of gun violence in video games, 62%. Of non-gun owners say that that contributes a great deal or a fair amount to the violent crime that we see in this country today. 57% of gun owners agree that violence in video games. When it comes to the amount of violence in movies and television, 61% of non-gun owners say that contributes to. 44% of gun owners agree. So apparently, according to this Pew survey, gun owners, more of them think violent video games have a contributing factor than violent movies and television. I don't know what would account for the sharp difference between those two mediums, but apparently there is one. And when it comes to the NRA, again, they say about one in five U.S. gun owners say they belong to the National Rifle Association. Were that it so? Republican and Republican-leaning gun owners are twice as likely as Democratic and Democratic-leaning gun owners to say that they belong to the NRA. 24% of those Republican and Republican-leaning gun owners versus 11% of self-identified Democrats or Democrat-leaning gun owners. Now, I think that's worth noting. And it's something that I wish more people on the left would note, that this is a bipartisan issue. This doesn't have to be a partisan issue. In fact, I would argue that the defense of our constitutional rights as American citizens absolutely should not be a partisan issue. It shouldn't be when we go to the polls in November having to choose between the pro-gun candidate and the anti-gun candidate. We should be able to choose between two candidates who both support and respect our right to keep and bear arms. And, you know, unfortunately, that I don't think it's the case in this country right now, but I am glad to see that there are still those pro-gun Democrats out there willing to acknowledge it to pollsters and still a part of the National Rifle Association, which is nonpartisan, which does support the candidate, Republican or Democrat, who earns the endorsement of the organization. And that's based on the votes that they are casting. That's based on if they're a first-time candidate, it's based on their answers to a candidate questionnaire. But again, I think as gun owners, we all benefit when we've got elected officials in both parties who are truly standing up for our rights. Now, they also asked the question, what do you think about the NRA's influence? What do you think about the NRA's influence? Because, you know, again, we're told that the gun lobby on a daily basis, we're told that this country would be so much safer if it weren't for the efforts of the gun lobby, right? So here's what this Pew survey found. 44% of all adults say the NRA has too much influence over gun legislation. Too much. 40% say it has the right amount of influence. And 15% say the NRA has too little influence. So if you're playing along at home or on the road, more than half the country says the NRA has either the right amount of influence or not enough influence in politics. 44% say it's got too much. But over 50%, what would that be? 55% say either, nah, we're good, or I wish we had more. That kind of contradicts, like, the tone of 98% of the opinion pieces we see about gun ownership and the power of the gun lobby, right? Pew notes that opinions about the NRA's influence driven largely by partisanship, a majority of Democratic gun owners and non-owners say the NRA has too much influence. 60% of Democratic gun owners, 67% of non-gun owners, while similar shares of Republican gun owners and non-gun owners say it has the right amount of influence. 67% of Republican gun owners, 62% of non-gun owners. Again, they didn't ask, I don't know, maybe there were no independents in this survey, but they didn't ask about the independents and their views. But there you go. 55% of America says they are okay with the NRA's influence in politics, or they want to see even more. Again, that's not anywhere close to what you'll see in the average opinion page. But I say that we did have this column today by Jay Ambrose, and I've seen it in several newspapers around the country. Gun control is fine, he says, except for the fact that it doesn't work. And a real dose of common sense, I think, on this issue. He says, among other things, he says, what about gun control nuts? People talk about the gun nuts all the time. He says, what about the gun control nuts? What about people who seem to think that murders will go down? Even if fewer guns are sold, even though a major crime drop starting in the 1990s was accompanied by a huge increase in the number of firearms. Yeah, we have that. I mean, that's the basic foundational premise of the anti-gun movement, whether they're calling themselves the gun safety movement or the gun control movement or the anti-gun movement, which they will never call themselves. But that's the basic premise, right? More guns equals more crime. That's what they always say. Except that in this country, the actual experience has been more guns, less crime. You know, in Virginia, this goes back a couple of years. I think this goes back to like 2015. But between something like 2010 and 2015, the number of background checks for firearms in Virginia doubled, while gun-related violent crime dropped like 25%. There were no screaming headlines in the national media about this. No gun control group even acknowledged this, because you can't. How do you acknowledge something like this? The science says that more guns equals more crime, even when it doesn't. Ambrose says, what about people who don't get that President Barack Obama's calls for gun control made him the biggest gun salesman in American history? Gun sales set records in the Obama years, largely because of the fear he might take their might make their purchase virtually impossible, he writes. Not a single law he wanted would have shrunk gun sales by a fraction as much as his rhetoric increased them. You know, that's kind of interesting, because you look at the numbers that we've seen recently. The NICS numbers for May were the highest May ever recorded. Man, Obama's out of office. Now we've got Donald Trump. But May 2017, higher than May of 2016 in terms of the number of NICS checks. I wonder, and it's just a theory, but I wonder if 5 to 10 years from now, we're able to look back at the Obama period, and we're able to see that there was still continued growth in gun ownership after President Obama left office. I'm wondering if a lot of this wasn't simply a matter of concern about additional gun control laws, but how much of this really has been a sea change in Americans in terms of self-defense. According to this Pew poll, 67% of Americans who are gun owners own a gun for self-defense. And I wonder how much that drove the increase that may have coincided with Barack Obama's time in office. And certainly maybe there's a combination of the two, right? Fears of new gun control laws, fears of new gun bans, coupled with that growing realization that I want to be able to protect myself. Because we certainly know, I don't think everything has been attached to Barack Obama. You look again at what we saw after the attacks in San Bernardino, after the attacks in Orlando, Florida last year, and there is usually an accompanying surge, not just in gun ownership, but in concealed carry applications. Events like that drive people to think about and cause people to think about, well, how would I protect myself? Now, Jay Ambrose points out a couple of other items that the gun control activists haven't really been thinking about or maybe don't want to talk about. He said, what about the fact that these so-called assault rifles are not assault weapons and the real ones are already banned? The military says an assault weapon is one that can be automatic. You press the trigger, the gun keeps shooting until you let up. Yeah, again, I even think most journalists, at least, and certainly every anti-gun activist, is aware of that difference. They just don't want to talk about it. Ambrose says, I myself do not object to more work on ways to keep guns out of the hands of criminals in the insane if Second Amendment limits are observed. Despite arguments to the contrary, he says the founders did believe gun possession was an individual right, militia or no militia. And he says it's also the case that the National Rifle Association does not have lobbying heft because it gets big dough from gun manufacturers, but because it represents millions of gun owners who happen to vote. I think he's right about that, with one exception. It's not that these millions of gun owners happen to vote. It's not random. It's not that, you know, a large percentage of NRA members just happen by the polling place on election day. No. It's that the NRA represents millions of gun owners who use this organization to speak with one voice when it comes to one issue, right? And that issue is our right to keep and bear arms. And that one voice is million strong. Most of the NRA members that I know are active in politics. They pay attention to what's going on. I ran into a guy as I was walking back from lunch yesterday, who I've met a couple of times. He's working construction here in on Main Street in Farmville. And he reads America's First Freedom every month. And we started talking about, he brought up the Virginia governor's race. And we started talking about it. And he's really well informed about what's going on. It's June. There are a lot of Virginians who don't even know that there's an election coming up in November this year. But this guy was on it. He's like, we got to get involved. We got to start. He's like, I'm talking to my friends already. He's like, good, because that's the number one thing. Got to make sure we're registered to vote. He was on it. And he's a construction worker in Farmville, Virginia. But he cares about this issue. And again, there are millions of NRA members around the country who are just like my buddy Matt. They care about this issue. So they don't just happen to go to the polls. They make a point to show up. They show up at the primaries. They show up on election day. They contact their representatives. They're an engaged voter. They're not a low information voter. They're not even a high information voter. They are an engaged voter. And that makes a difference. And again, imagine if we had 15 million engaged voters and NRA members. Imagine what we could do then. All right, stick around. We got to take a quick time out. When we come back, Mark Adler's going to join us, president of Machine Gun America down in Kissimmee, Florida, where they offered last weekend, and they're offering one again this weekend, a free firearm safety course. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
I'm speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. Emily, welcome. Tell me, what is NRA Hunters for the Hungry?
Well, NRA Hunters for the Hungry is a program that originally started back in 1993, and it is a way for hunters to either donate their protein or their time for a great cause.
That's a great idea. Why did NRA get involved with this? Why did they think it was important to do this?
NRA got involved because they were looking for an option for hunters to give back to their community, and something to help everyone at large. So this program allows you to do that. By donating the protein from your animals, it goes to either food shelter or it goes to shelters or food banks or churches or people in need in general.
That's great. So tell us a little bit, how does it work? How does a hunter walk us through either donate their protein or their time?
Currently, we have a fabulous website. And by going there, there's a Get Involved tab. And once you go there, we have a geotagged map on the website, which will put you in contact with a processor near you, as well as a taxidermist, if that's something you're interested in. As for donating your time, we also allow you to contact us, and we can put you in contact with the affiliate program that is closest to you.
Awesome. Speaking with Emily Mead with NRA Hunters for the Hungry. And, Emily, how do we get more information about the program?
To get more information about the program, you can either go to our website, which is huntersforthehungry.nra.org, or you can email us at hservices@nrahq.org, or you can even call at 1-800-492-4868.
Emily Mead, NRA Hunters for the Hungry. Thank you for what you do. Thanks for what the NRA does. This is great stuff, and thanks for being on the program.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Company. Cam Edwards, your host, right here on Sirius XM Patriot 125, NRATV.com, and more. Coming up about an hour from now, Paul Bedard joins us of the Washington Examiner. But right now, I'm very pleased to have with us the president of Machine Gun America down in Kissimmee, Florida. Mark Adler is with us. Mark, how are you, sir?
I am doing wonderful, sir. How are you today?
I am great. I appreciate you coming on the program. I saw this story earlier today from WFTV. Last week, you all offered a free firearm safety course, and you're doing it again coming up this Saturday. Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to be doing it again. We're going to have 20 people, the majority of which have little to no experience with firearms, coming in to do a basic safety course. And the purpose is to show people how to safely lock up their firearms when they're not in use. And the purpose of the course is just to familiarize them in the most basic of way with firearms and take some of the mysticism of it out.
I know that WFTV said that you're doing this in honor of the victims of the attack at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Are you reaching out specifically, Mark, to members of the LGBT community, or is this just open to anybody and everybody who wants to show up?
You know, we get that question asked a lot, obviously. After the Pulse tragedy, we had a lot of staff members that were directly affected by what went on, and we wanted to do something. We're the safety experts at Machine Gun America. We have a passion for firearms, and we thought the best possible thing that we could do is educate people about firearms. To address your question specifically, no, it is open to everyone. But last time, we did this last year, and in this past course, we did have some members from that community, and we welcome them, and we welcome anybody else that wants to come and give some education.
Well, I mean, that's the whole goal, right? Self-defense is a human right, and And so everybody needs access to this information. And I got to say, Mark, I mean, this is really what gun safety is all about. We hear that phrase thrown about a lot by people who I think more accurately would call themselves gun control advocates, but they like that phrase, gun safety. But gun safety doesn't mean don't own a gun and telling people don't own a gun and making it harder for people to own a gun. Gun safety is actually about education and training.
Listen, firearms exist in our society. They exist in our communities. The Second Amendment gives American citizens the right to own a firearm. And for those people that own them, we want them to be educated on them. You know, specifically, we took this three-pronged approach, and I don't want people to think it's just about the courses. Thanks to our friends at the National Shooting Sports Foundation and Sig Sauer, we were able to get a bunch of gun locks that we are giving out for free to anyone that comes through the door that wants to take it home and use it. And then if you own a firearm in the state of Florida and you want to transfer that gun to another citizen of the state of Florida, we're going to go ahead and do that for you for free, just so you can get that background check and get that peace of mind. So we're really trying to put our money where our mouth is. We are engaged in the gun safety, quote unquote, debate here in our community. And we want to make sure that we're reaching out and doing everything that we know to do in order to make sure people are as safe as they can be when it comes to firearms.
Talking with Mark Adler from Machine Gun America. So do you have any space available for Saturday, Mark?
You know, I do not know off the top of my head. I know that people can go to our Facebook page, Machine Gun America, or they can go to our website, machinegunamerica.com. And they're going to get a lot of information there. And you know, listen, we've said this from the beginning. If the response is overwhelming, we're going to do everything we can to accommodate people. Of course, you know, like anything else, there's a cost associated with putting these courses on. But It's important to us to give back to our community. So that's why we're doing it in the first place.
You know, on a broader level, I mean, outside of the free courses that you're offering, what are you seeing in terms of the demand for classes, the amount of activity there at your range? Are you still busy? Do you think that are we still seeing more Floridians start to think about their right to keep and bear arms and the right of self-defense?
You know, I don't think it's just about Floridians. I think it's about people in general. There is a curiosity when it comes to firearms. There has been a lot of negativity pumped out about firearms in the last couple of years, and I see a trend going against that. People are curious about what they can do with a firearm to protect themselves, but even more importantly, they're curious what firearms are all about, what they do, and what all of this scrutiny might be about. And I will tell you that many times we get brand new shooters that come in, have never shot a gun before, and they are absolutely thrilled to have the experience and to get the education from our safety experts, where they're 100% taken care of and kind of heralded or walked through the process, as it would be, and they feel really good about what they do, and we're real excited about that, what we do at our range, or at our attraction, rather. Excuse me.
That is awesome. Mark, listen, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. MachineGunAmerica.com, and again on Facebook and Machine Gun America as well. Hope we can chat again soon, Mark.
I'd be looking forward to it, and thank you for inviting us on.
Absolutely. Mark Adler with us from Machine Gun America there in Kissimmee, Florida. The free firearm safety course, the free gun locks, free transfers through the end of the month, according to WFTV. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie has pardoned two military veterans who ran afoul of the state's gun laws. NorthJersey.com says it's the latest in his ongoing effort to aid people who he believes have become victims of the gun laws. Yeah, 68-year-old Michael Golden, arrested in November of 2013, accused of having a gun in his Mahwah, New Jersey hotel room without a permit. Mr. Golden is an Army veteran who served in Vietnam, received a Purple Heart, according to the governor's office. 42-year-old James Michael Thaddeus Peterson was arrested in 2014 in Camden County, New Jersey. He was found to have a handgun after, quote, an altercation involving a traffic incident. He was convicted of unlawful transportation of a firearm, doesn't sound like he was the one who instigated the altercation after the traffic incident, since he was only convicted of unlawful transportation of a weapon. He was a corporal in the Marine Corps and the director of Veterans Services in Moore County, North Carolina. Both of these individuals, by the way, were prosecuted. The state spent time and money going after these individuals. They were both sentenced to a year's probation. That's it. Again, at what point can we start asking, okay, so you say you desperately need and want these laws on the books. Why? Why? she can spend the state's time and money prosecuting a 68-year-old man from New Mexico who broke your state's laws and brought that gun in. But your punishment is going to be a year's probation. But you're going to go through the time and the expense of an investigation, of a prosecution, of a trial in order to give this guy 1 year's probation. When in New Jersey right now, you've got serious violent crime problems in Camden and in Trenton and in Patterson and in Newark and in Jersey City. You're telling me this is the best use of your limited resources is to enforce this law? Really? Same, by the way, with 42-year-old James Michael Thaddeus Peterson got sentenced to a year's probation, which he was allowed to serve in North Carolina, where he's from. Mr. Golden was allowed to serve his probation in Mexico. Again, what point is served by prosecuting these individuals? There's no real punishment. There was no intent to violate the law. There was no intent to commit a violent crime, right? So why go through this process? It's not like the state of New Jersey has an infinite amount of prosecutors, has an infinite amount of judges, has an infinite amount of time and money to spend on these cases. You've got to prioritize. Why the hell are these priorities for any prosecutor in the state of New Jersey? Honest to God. NorthJersey.com says the pardons dated Monday announced Tuesday night. They're the first pardons that Christie has issued this year. But the governor has said he expects to issue many more as the final year of his term winds down. North Jersey says Christie has been focused mostly on pardoning people who have gun-related convictions since he's been unable to make significant changes to the state's gun laws under a Democratic-led legislature. Yeah, and it's entirely possible, by the way, that if a Democrat gets elected in New Jersey this year, because remember, we've got elections in New Jersey this year, it's entirely possible that the Democrat who gets elected is going to try to reverse course, got to make sure that individuals like this 68-year-old man from New Mexico do as much hard time as possible. Remember, Shanine Allen was facing 3 years in prison for her possession of a firearm. She was a legal gun owner, legal concealed carry holder in Pennsylvania, but drove across the state line into New Jersey and was facing years behind bars. And that's what the prosecutor wanted. He wasn't going to give her a year probation. She wasn't a member of the military. She didn't have that going for her. She's just a single mom. So, yeah, throw her in prison. And I imagine we're going to be getting back to those bad old days in New Jersey if a anti-gun candidate gets elected governor there. Meanwhile, again, the real question is who's benefiting from these prosecutions? I don't think the state of New Jersey benefits. I don't think these individuals learn any sort of lesson here. I think the lawmakers are the ones who need to learn a lesson. Get rid of this stupid law. Get rid of it. Get rid of this bad law. Or Congress, this is why we need national right to care reciprocity. You know, and that way the prosecutors in New Jersey, they can't make these stupid cases a priority. Maybe they'll be forced to focus on the actual violent criminals who are making life dangerous for people in places like Newark and Camden and Trenton. All right. Just a couple of minutes left here on the program this hour. Laura Carno and the Coalition for Civil Liberties and the faster training that is underway in Colorado this week, this is starting to get some national attention now. I feel good. We've been talking about this for months, but now everybody else started to pick up on this. BBC had a story earlier this week. Fox News had a story yesterday. More than a dozen Colorado teachers received training on how to fire back at active shooters in schools in a program that gun rights advocates call essential. Laura Carno described its program, quote, in a nutshell, as training for teachers and other school staff who are armed first responders in their school. One of the teachers participating, Ronnie Wilson, says he's open to open up a K-12 charter school in Colorado Springs. He says he gets questions in equal numbers about school safety and academics from parents. He says, I'm looking for every possible venue and avenue to ensure the safety of students. Isn't that interesting? That parents are equally concerned about safety and academics. You would think again that academics would be first and foremost in the parents' mind, but not in the day and age we live in. They are concerned about the safety of their kids when they go to school. Fox reports that Ronnie Wilson, the only one of the 17 teachers and staff, was willing to share his identity. Laura Carno So there's a confidentiality aspect to all of this as well. Each participating school district can decide how public or private it wants to be when it comes to having staff members of this training exercise and who will be armed at school, which makes sense. But I also would not be surprised if some of these educators decided that it was better to keep it quiet because they didn't want to be the subject of grief or protests. Sad as it is, I mean, you've got, again, the anti-gun activists, they're not happy about this in Colorado. I'm sorry, the gun safety activists aren't happy about this training that is underway in Colorado this week. You would think that they would be, since they are gun safety advocates, but no, they're not. Tom Mauser is a member of Colorado Ceasefire. His son was killed at Columbine. And he said, quote, these teachers are not going to get the level of training that law enforcement or really high-trained security guards are going to have. Now, again, keep in mind that the law in Colorado already allows these teachers to carry. Law in Colorado already allows this. The only thing that's happening this week is that these teachers are getting trained. They're getting training, quite frankly, thanks to the generosity of people like you contributing to the FASTER program, because it costs money to do this. And every one of these educators is getting a scholarship. They're not paying a dime for this. So what's the objection? If you want to change the law in Colorado, and I bet Tom Mauser does, and I'm sure Shannon Watts would like to change it too. Maybe she'll talk about this if she runs for Congress, to disallow these districts to make that choice for themselves as to whether or not to designate any members of the staff as security officers. But right now, that's the law in Colorado. These districts can do that. There are staff members who are carrying. So the objection here is to those staff members getting this training. That's a weird thing to object about. All right, when we come back, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center joins us. Top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy and more. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this. Jen O'Hara and Narissa Harmon, the Girls with Guns, are with us. Listen, you've got the clothing company, but this is the Girls with Guns brand. It is about far more than just the apparel. I mean, this is a real lifestyle, and you all have, Girls with Guns, the hunting experience. You all have traveled all over the world over the past few years hunting. Why? What? Explain to somebody who's watching who doesn't hunt, why do you do this? Why do you go travel to foreign countries to go shoot animals? Why do you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and brave the elements and oftentimes come back empty-handed? Why do you do these things?
You know, I don't know. I think each person has their own experience when it comes to hunting. For me personally, it started out growing up on a farm as a kid and really learning about where our food comes from. And my dad hunted to feed our family, as well as we raised our own cattle, sheep, goats, chickens, everything. And, you know, that experience takes on its new form as you grow into an adult. And I chose hunting as my lifestyle. It's something that I fully believe in. Organic meat, filling my freezer, feeding my family. The foreign countries bring a whole new experience for Narissa and I. And one of the things that I really love about that experience is that we're able to actually go in and feed villages. Because we aren't able, because of U.S. regulations, to bring all the meat back. We always eat in camp as much as we can during our stay. But for example, 2 years ago, I harvested one of the dangerous seven, my first hippo, in Zimbabwe. And we actually got to watch an entire village come. There was pregnant women carrying meat on their head, walking back. And it was a humbling experience. We've given meat to orphanages and retirement homes all throughout Africa. We've gone to New Zealand, Argentina, Canada. We've been all over. And it's just one of those experiences you can't really explain to maybe somebody who's not a hunter, but as you take in one of my things that I've been doing is mentoring our youth in different programs and teaching them and taking them to hunt and really letting them understand that experience.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that you're reaching out. And as hard as it can be to explain to non-hunters, we have to try.
Yes.
Because the anti-hunting activists are out there. They definitely want to stop what you're doing. And you know, you just described what an anti-hunting activist would call a trophy hunt, right? Where you went to Africa, you shot a hippo. And yet, it's not. It's about far more than the trophy, right? Now, you may get to bring back the skin. You may get to go to a taxidermist. You might have to take out a second mortgage to get a hippo stuffed. But it's not a trophy hunt for those folks, as you say, who are benefiting. Not just economically, not just, you know, the economic impact of that village, but you're putting food on the table for people.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, I mean, like you said, the impact of it. I mean, we were able to see all the money and the benefits that go back into the community. So we're having food that's going back, water. I mean, there's so much things on conservation levels that Jen and I have learned, and I'm proud that our clothing brand has taken us and given us these opportunities because we're able to share it with the girls and the audiences. And those moments, I hold dear and near to my heart just because I've never seen anything like that. And I'm thankful that we've had that opportunity.
Now, selfishly, though, hunting is fun. I mean, that's the other side of this, right? It's just, it's fun.
Yeah. You know, hunting is a huge passion of mine. It's something that, if I was able to, I would do absolutely every day just to get out and be one with nature, with God. It's our experience. And really, for us, a lot of it's about the journey. When you say coming home empty-handed, some of those hunts, my most recent one was last year in Canada, and Arissa harvested a bear, and I didn't. I had a blast on that trip. And it's about the people that you're with and the journey along the way. And those are the memories that I remember as I reminisce about these hunts and the different animals I've harvested. There's challenges that go into hunting. There's training. There's equipment. And you really have to be strong, and you have to try, and, you know, mentally strong, too, just in some instances. And I just think that it's something that we love, and we really try to focus on the good parts of it, because I do understand that some people look at it as trophy hunting, and for us, it's not. It's about feeding those villages. It's giving back to conservation, to that wildlife. Without hunters, especially in parts of Africa that we've been to, there would be no more wildlife, because they would go extinct because they have no value to those people, and so they would just over-harvest them because the regulations wouldn't be there.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. We've got Paul Bedard and the ever-popular Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, join us next hour as well. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Media Research Center, vindication for Tim Graham at the Media Research Center. Most Americans agree the media is biased in one way or another. Tim, have you just been walking around today saying, see, I told you so?
Well, we've seen many polls confirming and reconfirming what everyone knows to be true, which is the media hates Trump and they don't hide it. You know, when Time Magazine's got him, Trump melty face, and then 2 months or 3 months later does Trump puddle face, you know, nobody is hiding that they hate this guy's guts. And so when you go and take a poll and you say, do you think the media likes President Trump? 4% say yes, which means they're not very bright. That of course is the Rasmussen poll today. I mean, there's also this YouGov.com poll.
Uh-huh.
Every poll that's been done in recent years has found the liberal, you know, people feel the media favors one side. Republicans are especially adamant about the media favor one side, and it ain't ours. The debate moderators, the public felt the debate moderators were going to favor one side, which they did. And so, I mean, this is the state of play. Everyone understands basically that the media is liberal and that they are, they create the news in such a way to help the liberal view succeed. And then they get really upset when their propaganda doesn't work.
You know, and it's interesting, Tim, because I think on the left now, you've got people who say that let's say the MSNBCs of the world are the sort of corporate Democrat, right? You've got the split between the split between the Clinton camps and the Bernie camps, and the Bernie camp says that the left leaning media doesn't go far enough, right? That they're squelched and they're stifled and they're not allowed to present truly progressive voices. It's kind of fascinating that you've got this belief on the left that the that even the left-leaning media is showing some sort of, I don't want to say conservative bias, but they're not allowed to let their progressive freak flag fly.
Well, they're freaking out today because MSNBC is going to give a couple hours on the weekends to Hugh Hewitt.
Oh my gosh, this guy's falling.
And they were like, one guy tweeted, I had to retweet this, ban cable news.
Ban cable news?
Here's your liberal for you. Cannot stand 2 hours of Hugh Hewitt in a 24/7 environment. It actually reminds me of the way liberals responded to PBS when we had like a year where on Friday nights there was the Wall Street Journal editorial report and Tucker Carlson Unfiltered, both of which were mild conservative programs, but mild in PBS-ian tone.
Yeah.
And they just could not stand that these programs were on the air, the liberals. They could not stand that there was 1 hour a week, just like there, back in the day there used to be 1 hour of Bill Buckley. They just couldn't stand it. You know, and that's what's fascinating, is that liberals are used to dominating. It's the same reason they hate Fox News. We have 17 TV networks and newspapers, and that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We must have them all. You know, I mean, that's what's going on. So people understand the state of play. I mean, Democrats, 52% in the Rasmussen survey said, yep. Or I guess in the YouGov survey. I mean, they know. Democrats know the media favor them. They know. And anybody who denies it, again, is just playing games. But yes, you could say, if I'm a radical revolutionary communist or something, the media is too establishment for me. You know, Bernie Sanders got an incredibly positive press. He just didn't get enough press. You could argue he didn't get enough airtime. But the airtime that Sanders received in 2015 and 16 was very positive. Nobody really wanted to say, this is a terrible human being. They weren't going to talk about how he his ideas of female rape fantasies or anything embarrassing in his past, his three houses, whatever. I mean, there just wasn't negative coverage of Sanders.
There wasn't even really negative coverage of his political opinions. I mean, like, you know, like they didn't even really drill down, right? I mean, what does it mean to be a democratic socialist who doesn't caucus with the Democrats but is running as a Democrat? Like, that, you know, that's kind of interesting, Tim, but that really wasn't what the political reporters really wanted to focus on with Bernie. They wanted to talk about the crowds and the energy, and they were just amazed at this, you know, old guy with white hair was bringing all these young people out, and that was sort of where it stopped.
Well, I think that their feeling was, again, I think they're very much strategic thinkers in the way that they decide how to cover this stuff, and that was they decided, Sanders, there's no way he's going to win. I think they were much more pessimistic about the chance that he had. I mean, actually, the amount of his coverage in 15 was not very impressive. You know, he did kind of catch fire. And then so they wanted to cover him, but they didn't want to cover him too negatively because they knew that the Bernie voters should be Hillary voters. And they were always trying to make sure that the fight didn't get too harsh. They didn't encourage these two to pound each other. The way that they get, you know, they love the idea of Republican fratricide. They're trying to encourage that at all times.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons they really liked Trump early on, because he was basically like, yeah, you're little Marco, you're lying Ted, you're a low energy Jeb. And they loved all of those. And now there's crying Charlie Schumer. But crying Chuck was today's Trumpism. But you know, it didn't end up working out. I mean, they weren't really interested in what WikiLeaks found, which was that the Democratic National Committee was all organized to shut Bernie down.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, this is something that is still very much on the mind of a lot of people, a lot of those Bernie Sanders supporters. You listen to Sirius XM Progress, for example. I tune in every now and then to hear what the other side's saying, and you know, they've not let that go. I mean, we talk about people on the left more generally not being able to accept the election results. You got people on the left who still haven't accepted the primary election results. I mean, they are still furious.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of those ideas that this is where I think conservatives and liberals are different. You know, they made such a huge deal out of conservatives didn't accept Obama's legitimacy. And it's like, okay, we had people who thought he was born in Kenya. But, you know, I think we could all look at that and say, well, he seems to have won by 5 points. So there's no really questioning that Obama had won these elections. But this, it's different to say, I accepted he's president and I'm going to oppose him with all that I've got. That's American. But they presented opposing Obama as A, racist, and B, stupid, and C, somehow unpatriotic. But it's, you know, and obviously all of that drops right out of the floor when the parties are switched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Tim, I do appreciate you coming on the program, and I know we've only got a couple hours here before the evening news starts, and that's a whole new news cycle for you folks there at Newsbusters, but thank you very much for your time today.
You bet.
All right, we'll do it again soon. Tim Graham, Tim J. Graham on Twitter, newsbusters.org. Top of the hour, today's Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, Good Guy and More. Meanwhile, in Virginia election news, WVFT, which is public radio in Virginia, Radio IQ. Gun safety advocates, Michael Pope reports, are hoping to make an early impact on the statewide elections. I can't do the public radio voice anymore. I'm sorry. He writes that guns are expected to play a central campaign theme for the upcoming statewide election in Virginia, and advocates for gun safety are making an early move to make their case. Every town for gun safety and Moms Demand Action are endorsing all three Democrats on the statewide ballot, a ticket led by Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam. Somebody, they don't say who, but somebody with Everytown says, we want to emphasize, this is their quote. What have we been talking about? Building the narrative, right? What do we build that narrative of we're reasonable people. We're not anti-gun. You can trust us. Forget everything that's happened with the gun control movement over the past 40 years in this country. Forget it all. It's a brand new day. Here's the quote. We want to emphasize that we support the Second Amendment. We're not here to take people's guns away from them. We're just here to talk about responsible gun ownership, and that's what we'll do in 2017. Okay. Not here to take any of the guns away. Just here to talk about responsible gun ownership. WVTF says that these quote-unquote gun safety advocates say they want to close the, quote, gun show loophole and restore the, quote, one gun a month restriction that was overturned several years ago. Okay, so let's talk about responsible gun ownership here. Because supposedly every town for gun safety doesn't want to take anybody's guns away, right? They want to emphasize that they support the Second Amendment. They want to emphasize they support the Second Amendment. They're not here to take people's guns away from them. They're just here to talk about responsible gun ownership. Okay. So if I go to a gun store and I fill out the 4473, and I undergo a background check, and I pass that background check, why can't I buy two guns in a month? What's the issue there? I'm a responsible gun owner. I just passed the background check. So what's your issue with me buying two firearms? You know, again, they're repeating the talking points that they've been told to talk about. But they don't really make a whole hell of a lot of sense. We're not here to take anybody's guns away. We totally support the Second Amendment. We just think that you should be rationed in the amount of guns that you could purchase per month. As a responsible gun owner, we still think that you should be rationed. Okay. That's like saying I support the First Amendment, but I think you should be able to send 10 tweets a month. I support the First Amendment, but, you know, you really should only be able to write one letter to the editor, like, every year. Or I support the First Amendment, but, you know, you really should only be able to take part in one political protest per month. Just one. We got marches on Washington like every weekend now. But I really think that, you know, just I'm not anti-Second Amendment. I support the Second Amendment. I support your idea of free speech and everything. But, you know, look, it's bad for the environment. Trash gets all over the place. And then there's the carbon footprint of going back and forth to D.C. all the time. So I it's not that it's an anti-free speech move. I just want to limit your ability to speak. That's all. How well would that go over? Again, I'm perfectly happy to have this conversation with the folks who claim that they support the Second Amendment. I'm just trying to figure out how it is that their agenda is actually in line with their public statements about what it is that they want compared to the policy goals that they are hoping to achieve. Cameron, can you figure that out? Is there something with the one gun a month restriction? Am I responsible for that first gun, but then all of a sudden if I want that second firearm of the month, then I become an irresponsible gun owner?
I guess so. I don't know where they get these numbers and these figures from, so it's hard to follow even as you talk about it.
Yeah, it kind of is. WVTF says, back in 2015, every town pumped more than $2 million into a handful of close state Senate races. Let's be honest, it wasn't every town, okay? It was Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg's name, by the way, appears nowhere in this story for WVTF. Nowhere. It's all grassroots, right? It's all locally based. Not out-of-state billionaires from New York coming in. No way. Yeah, Virginia Public Radio. Gotta love it. Back in 2015, they report, every town pumped more than $2 million into a handful of close state Senate races. They failed to take the majority, but they also didn't lose any seats. Now a spokeswoman for the group declined to say how much money they would pump into television advertising this fall. Let's put it this way. It's got to make that $2 million ad buy look like chump change. Oh, and this public radio report from Virginia Public Radio also made possible support from the Virginia Education Association. So glad to know where our fake news is coming from. All right, stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company. It's on the way right after this.
Citizenry makes for a stronger country, a stronger society, a safer society.
And we prepare for so much that leads up to pulling the trigger. Are you prepared to deal with what happens after?
It's as complete a package as we could possibly have put together. We want to give someone the tools so that they can make good decisions in a very stressful, probably the most stressful situation that they'll ever encounter.
Having the NRA actually put together standardized concealed carry training and putting the resources behind it, you know, says quite a bit.
Everybody involved has that real world experience, has the education, has the understanding.
You know that this training is safe and it will work.
From the tactical, we're ready up.
It's far easier than anyone understands for an innocent person to be convicted of a crime.
We live in a litigious society. You need an attorney that understands what you've gone through, that understands the legal parameters of this situation, and is going to be able to not just adequately defend your rights, but to defend your rights from the tyranny of restrictions that prevent you from being able to defend yourself. Protect yourself. Get Carry Guard.
Call 911, wait for the law enforcement to show up, and then call the emergency hotline on the back of their NRA Carry Guard membership card that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to all NRA Carry Guard members.
When we're talking about something like the NRA, we're talking about the largest civil rights organization in the country.
There is no other entity that has the expertise, the resources, the connections, the philosophy, and the infrastructure.
There is no other organization in the United States of America that can do what NRA has done with Carry Guard. There is no organization that gives you that gold standard protection and assurance.
If I find myself in a position where I had to use my gun to defend my life, I can tell you right now, I'm going to be glad that I had the Carry Guard.
Wild turkey, venison stew, roasted pheasant, rabbit risotto. The chemical-free, just-picked ingredients and the absence of antibiotics in the freshest of meats are the essence of today's farm-to-table food culture.
But hunters have been eating this way for centuries. This is their table, and this is their farm. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company. It starts right this second, fueled by Hornady here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. We've got Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner joining us here in just a little bit, talking about that Pew survey on gun owners. According to Pew, 7 in 10 American adults have fired a gun at some point. 67% of gun owners surveyed by Pew say that they primarily own a firearm for self-protection. And it's interesting. So there's a Politico headline out right now. And this is, again, this is why I say take these polls with grains of salt, as many as you want. So the Politico headline, 52% of Americans want stricter gun laws. That's one of the takeaways from this Pew survey. Another takeaway from this Pew survey is that 55% of Americans say the NRA has either the right amount of influence or not enough influence in Congress. And only 44% of Americans say the NRA has too much influence in Congress. So 52% say, well, we want more gun laws. And 55% say, you know what, I like the fact that the NRA is as involved as they are in D.C. And I wish some of them say I wish that the NRA had even more influence. I don't know. Those two numbers seem to kind of be in contradiction to one another. But we'll talk about it with Paul Bedard. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, joins us a little bit later on in the program as well. And right now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, good guy as well. Two good guys, as a matter of fact, today. Hero of the day from the Salt Lake Tribune. A female armed robber thwarted by a female employee of a Quiznos during a robbery in Salt Lake City. They call it a takeover style robbery Tuesday night at a Quiznos. Apparently, about 6 o'clock in the evening, three individuals, one female, two men, entered the Quiznos. They locked the door behind them, and then they produced two handguns. According to police, there were two employees in the store, one at the front counter, one in the back. One of the robbers was trying to get money from the register. The other two robbers then tried to go into the back of the store. The second employee, the one in the back of the store, barricaded herself behind the door by just pushing on it with her body. She had a firearm on her person, and she began firing that gun around the edge of the door. Employee fired 2 to 6 shots. One bullet hit the female robber. Another hit a window. And then the robbers, the two male robbers left, leaving the female robber behind. No honor among thieves. Police say the employee began shooting, quote, because of the severity of the situation. Said it was a takeover-style robbery, which is much more dangerous for everyone involved. We don't see very many of those. It was a very scary situation. Yeah. Female suspect's name not been released, in serious condition as of yesterday. Police looking for a male person of interest affiliated with the female suspect, a 36-year-old named Cody Shane Durant. Also sought as a person of interest, a Hispanic male, 30 to 40 years old, with short hair. No name, according to Salt Lake City Police Detective Greg Wilking. But that armed Quiznos employee, able to protect herself and her coworker, today's hero of the day. I hope tomorrow we don't see a story about that female employee there at Quiznos fired for protecting herself and her coworker. Meanwhile, today's deal of the day from the Murfreesboro, Tennessee Daily News Journal. Mariah Timms reports that a Murfreesboro man has been arrested on several charges of sexual battery, possibly involving a juvenile. Now, I don't know if it's actually fair to say that this guy is a Murfreesboro man. He may have been living in Murfreesboro, but he was doing so illegally. 41-year-old Badio Giron Gabriel has been charged with three counts of sexual battery, and other charges may be forthcoming, according to the police report. Detective Tommy Roberts reported that an unknown person reported seeing Gabriel molesting someone on June the 5th. A DHS, Child Protective Services investigation, led to the identification of the victim. The victim was interviewed, led to the disclosure of, quote, multiple instances of sex abuse by Gabriel. The Judicial Commissioner's Office agreed to issue an arrest warrant for him. He was transported to the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center without incident back on June 19th. And that's when booking officers were made aware of a connection to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. A report by Detective Tommy Roberts says, while there, a booking officer advised that they had spoken to ICE and were advised that Gabriel had a lengthy criminal history and had been deported multiple times, and they were putting a hold on him. Murfreesboro Police Department report indicates that Gabriel was born in Guatemala, a Murfreesboro residence listed as his address in the police report. ICE has confirmed that they have an officer looking into the case. No further details have been released as of yet, but an individual with a very lengthy criminal history, deported multiple times, now behind bars once again. Badio Giron Gabriel is today's deal of the day. Our heroes, as I mentioned, we've got two. First, from Fox 5 in Atlanta, Georgia, Forsyth County, Deputy First Class Mike Nelson is being honored for his efforts to save the life of a toddler. It was a neighborhood pool party. He was off duty. He was just going to a pool party in the neighborhood. And right before he shows up, he hears screams from the backyard where the pool party is being held. He said the mom and the dad started screaming, "Somebody help. We need help." They had just found their daughter at the bottom of the pool. She had just turned 2 years old. Nelson said his daughter wasn't breathing. She was blue in the face. He helped the father pull the girl out of the pool, started CPR. Deputy Nelson has been certified in CPR for more than 15 years. He says this is the youngest person he's ever performed CPR on. He says he thinks the little girl was underwater for about 2 minutes. He performed CPR for more than 2 minutes. She started breathing again. He says she started spitting up. She started crying. He says, "I felt a big sense of relief, a sense of joy." And Deputy Mike Nelson has received a life-saving award and a medal from the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office. And now he's taking that experience, and he's organizing summer CPR classes at that local community pool where this took place. He said, "Kids are going to be kids. Sometimes accidents happen. The better prepared that people can be, the better chance of something like this, where everything turns out with a positive note." Again, that's real safety. That's not like, you know, well, I'm a pool safety advocate, and I believe they should close every pool in the country. I believe we should make it incredibly hard for people to go to a pool. No, this is real safety. Let's make sure that there's an adult there who knows CPR, who's got that training and education that could come in handy if it's absolutely needed. So Deputy Mike Nelson there in Forsyth County, Georgia, our first good guy of the day. Our second good guy from Fox 19 in Middletown, Ohio, Officer Shioki Reese, was at a graduation party when she noticed a kid floating in the pool face down. Not doing the dead man's float. She said everybody was paying attention. Everybody was playing. Everybody had eyes on everyone. It's just that fast, she said. So she called out to the child's older brother to get him out of the pool. And then Officer Reese started CPR, got a pulse. Eventually, child began breathing again. She said, "Your training kicks in. You don't even think about it." She said, "I mean, it wasn't after everything was done that I actually thought, wow, that really just happened." Child's father says if Officer Reese wasn't at the party, he truly believes that he would have lost his son that day. Gleb Estep says, "She's my saving grace. I mean, she's an angel." I think we've got a picture, actually, of Officer Shioki Reese and the 8-year-old who she saved. That 8-year-old, it looks like he's doing better. He's got the swagger going. I hope that Gene Simmons doesn't sue him for the devil horns, because I think Gene Simmons has taken out a patent on that. But hopefully he'll let that one slide. But there you go. A very happy Officer Shiyoki Reese and a guy, a little kid full of swagger there in Middletown, Ohio. Shiyoki Reese in the right place at the right time. Again, able and equipped to do the right thing. She is today's second good guy of the day. All right, we're going to be talking with Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner here in just a few minutes. Kurt Schlichter of Town Hall. Had you heard, by the way, Cameron, that Gene Simmons has tried to trademark the devil horn sign? I'm afraid to actually do it.
I hadn't heard that, but as a longtime Howard Stern fan, Howard has talked for years about how Kiss and Gene Simmons, they try to put their name on everything. There's like Kiss coffins, and this guy just tries to trademark and put a logo on every possible thing. So I'm far from shocked.
Well, now that Peter Criss is retiring, maybe they need an extra revenue stream, because the four original members of Kiss, you're not going to be able to go see them. And I tell you what, we've got one more story here. This is not a deal of the day, because it's from Canada. So we stick to American stories for our deal of the day. But I saw this earlier today, and it just really, it really amazed me. It's a story out of Winnipeg. A woman who stabbed, I'm not making any of this up, by the way. It's going to sound like I'm making this up. I'm not making any of this up. A woman who stabbed her 89-year-old neighbor 68 times for no apparent reason says she's not a monster, but was in a, quote, very bad state after going off her medication weeks before. 37-year-old Melissa Joyce Gabriel made the comments in a handwritten statement delivered by her lawyer after Gabriel was sentenced Wednesday to 12 years for the manslaughter of Dorothy Dykens. Dykens was found dead in her home in May of 2015, a bent knife blade still in her back. This woman died from 68 stab wounds, 89 years of age, and her killer is getting 12 years behind bars. That is amazing to me. It gets worse. The sentence was 5 years longer than the 7 years that Gabriel's lawyers had requested from the provincial court judge. It fell short of the 15 years that the Crown was seeking, according to DurhamRegion.com. Now, here's the thing. The judge described the killing of Dykens as a vicious random attack on an extremely vulnerable victim. She lived alone. She had few relatives. The judge said that the suspect in this case, Gabriel, had long been aware of her propensity to get violent when drinking. That, the judge said, combined with her history of mental illness, made her a, quote, ticking time bomb. He said, unless these problems are met head on, you remain a danger to yourself and others. It was Gabriel who actually called 911 several times and alerted police to what had happened. Officers found blood-soaked knives as they walked up to her apartment. They found a poodle-type dog that had been stabbed hiding underneath the porch. Inside, they say, Gabriel was, quote, obviously intoxicated. Liquor bottles surrounded her on the floor. At the time, she was on court-ordered probation, but she was barred from drinking. Not long after they took Gabriel into custody, police found Dykens' body in her own home with Gabriel's cell phone underneath her. Gabriel told police in a 10-hour recorded interview, this isn't the first time and it won't be the last. The local paper says Gabriel has numerous mental health disorders, including antisocial personality disorder. In layman's terms, I want to make sure I get this right. I think this is her attorney. In layman's terms, that's a psychopath. Okay. So you have a psychopath, someone with mental illness, who, by the way, 55 previous convictions for this 37-year-old. 55, including 11 previous convictions for violence. So let me get this straight. In Canada, when you've got somebody who's been diagnosed with a mental illness, who has killed somebody, previously 11 other cases of violent crime, at what point do you say it's not safe for you to be by yourself? it's not safe for us to just say, you know what, you get to police your drinking, you get to make sure you're on your medication, you get to do all of this stuff. Is it, what is it, the 13th time that's the charm? What does it take? How many people are going to have to be victimized before there's some conclusion that, you know what, right now, this individual not fit to be out in society? The judge said that pre-sentencing reports had left him with the impression that the suspect in this case had, quote, buried her head in the sand with regards to treatment for her alcohol abuse. As a result, Ms. Gabriel was allowed to let her afflictions go unchecked. I'm amazed by this. And 12 years, I mean, 12 years for the murder of an 89-year-old, like that's, in a way, that's like the least bad part of this awful story. What does it take to actually get that mental health treatment? Because, you know, here's the thing. I don't know what it's like in Canada as far as early release goes. But I'm guessing that this 37-year-old, even if she does all 12 years, she's going to be out before she's 50. Is it going to address any of the underlying issues? Or is the, again, is there going to be a 13th time there in Manitoba? So an honorary Canadian deal of the day today for Melissa Joyce Gabriel there in Winnipeg. All right, when we come back after a quick break, Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner, Kurt Schlichter at Town Hall will be with us later in the hour. A lot more Second Amendment news and information still to come, so stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this. We're talking with George Ford from Nat Warfare. So what is Nat Warfare all about?
Okay, well, Nat Warfare is about a lot of fun. So what we do is we have a line of tactical training targets and aerial target drones. So half the business we have set up, we do experience-type shoots with these planes right back here for charity fundraisers, team-building experiences, corporate events. And the other side of the business, we produce tactical training targets for LE and military.
How did you get into this? You were active-duty military yourself, correct?
Nope, active patriot. And I was in the construction trades for 25-plus years and started getting a little bit older and thought, we need to do something a little more fun. So we just kind of got into it. We started with the planes, and it just evolved into all this now.
All right, so help me out here. This is actually a target that we're looking at.
Yes, it is. This is an aerial target, and this is a shotgun-based platform. On the bottom of the plane, there's 12 pyrotechnic charges. So what it is, it's a team shooting sport. We'll set five shooters up on the shooting line. We launch the plane. The plane flies by the shooting line. The pilot rolls the bottom of the plane out to expose the targets. Each shooter takes two shots per pass, five passes per team. And we land the plane, and we score it on how many of the exploding charges they hit on it. The planes are extremely durable. They're made out of coroplast, so the shot just penetrates right through the wing. We land the plane, put new pods on it, fuel it back up, throw it back on the catapult, and away we go.
That is amazing.
It's a lot of fun.
How did you come up with this idea?
It's actually, we saw this, as the concept started in England, and we ended up purchasing a few of their planes. You know how we are over here in America. We like to make things better, safer, faster, and so we kind of developed it into our own platform.
That is so cool. So can people buy these, or how does this work?
So what we do is we're based out of Scottsdale, Arizona.
Okay.
So we have a footprint that we travel to. We didn't really plan on getting into the manufacturing side until it started catching on and people wanted us to travel all over the country. So what we do now is we offer a turnkey business, basically. So we sell complete NAT systems. For $23,500, you can get a basically turnkey business. And that includes like 14 ready-to-fly planes, the launcher, enough consumables to get you through about four or five shoots, the whole nine yards, and you're off to the races.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people than crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire, with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem.
Either we fight this cancer of corruption or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
There are places only the hunter knows. Places where there is nowhere else. Where if you think of nothing, perhaps you will feel the ceaseless past begin to stir beneath your feet. And a chorus of voices whisper something you could never explain how you know. What it felt like the moment the mammoth appeared. The utter stillness of the battle. And the primal celebration that followed the kill. But maybe you don't need to explain it. Maybe it explains you. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information, it is Gam and Company right here on NRA TV and Sirius XM Patriot 125. Kurt Schlichter at Town Hall joins us in just a little bit right now from the Washington Examiner on Twitter at Secrets Bedard. Paul Bedard is with us. Paul, how are you, sir?
Hey, great day. How you doing?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the program, and really glad to see you writing about this Pew survey on gun ownership. It's kind of interesting. You know, I always say I take every poll with some grains of salt. I don't know that any poll is a perfect snapshot, and I've got some questions about some of the numbers and figures in this Pew survey, but generally speaking, I still think that you can learn things from a poll, even if the numbers are not going to be absolutely 100% on the dot accurate. You say some of the key findings in this survey: 7 in 10 adult Americans say that they have fired a gun. At least 2/3 have lived in a household with a gun. 3 in 10, according to this survey, say that they own a gun. Another 11% say they currently live in a home with someone who owns a gun. And only about 1/3 of Americans say they don't own a gun and they don't want one.
I thought the survey was pretty interesting in that, you know, it showed that the country has a real familiarity with guns, and that's kind of a Pew's conclusion, too. And, you know, you don't get that. I mean, I live inside the Washington bubble, so you don't really get that feeling that people, you know, in urban areas get that. You know, a lot of the country is very familiar with guns, with gun ownership. Half of them say that they grew up in families that had guns, and that kind of jives with a lot of figures back in the 70s and 80s that, you know, half homes had them. And you know, Cam, it also looked at kind of some of the, I guess, the more controversial issues with ownership. And there, Pew also found that there is some agreement with gun owners and non-gun owners, especially on issues like gun safety and teaching safety to their kids. And even on, you know, kind of gun control-ish issues, like, you know, everyone agrees there should be a background check and agrees that those who have mental issues shouldn't have access to them. So it's about 100 questions or so to almost 4,000 people.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, some of that, when they get into the specifics, Paul, I'm always curious, like, because, you know, again, it's very easy to offer up a one-sentence, do you like this? You actually start looking at the legislation. And you look at, okay, well, how do you want to accomplish this? That never gets asked, right? So I thought it was interesting that, and two, you can kind of slice and dice this. So there's a headline out, I think, in Politico right now, 52% of Americans say they support more gun control. But if you look at this Pew survey, 55% of Americans say when it comes to the NRA, they have either the right amount of influence or they should have more political influence. And only 44% say the NRA has too much influence. So I think, you know, again, with these 100 questions, maybe in some cases we're able to also spot some inconsistencies in the American position.
Oh, sure. And you know, reporters, I mean, we love these polls because you can you can pick whatever angle you want, and two stories seem totally opposite. Actually, they're in agreement because you can kind of cherry pick your numbers on this. But, you know, there were a bunch of highlights, and one of them I thought really stood out was 61% of the country have a positive view of gun owners. That's a figure you never hear about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they believe that, you know, generally people who own a weapon are trained or have gone through some sort of explanatory class and know what they're doing. And it's a kind of refreshing view, I think, of how the country looks at us.
I agree with that. And I think that Stat, you and I had kind of talked about this on Twitter a little bit earlier. 1 in 5 gun owners say they belong to the NRA. Now, I wish that were the case.
Yeah.
But as you pointed out, Paul, 1 in 5 gun owners, according to the survey, which would be between 15 and 20 million Americans, they say they belong to the NRA. They may very well think that they belong to the NRA. And certainly that would indicate that that they're allied with the NRA, that these are other Americans who are on board with the NRA's message and the NRA's mission. And that is... You're talking about 20 million Americans. Paul, that's a huge number of Americans involved and engaged on a political issue, particularly on one side of a political issue.
You know, when I do stories about NRA positions and those who belong and those who don't, the NRA always says, listen, you know, we have 5 to 8 million members, depending on the time of year. But a lot of people think just by virtue of buying a weapon, they feel like they get ownership or they get membership in, and the numbers the NRA typically puts out are about what Pew found. Mm-hmm. About 20 million people think they belong to the NRA, which gives the organization tremendous extra power when it goes into lobby and when it goes in to talk about issues, and also when it promotes, you know, issues like safety. Like, for example, today, you know, Chris Cox of ILA has said, listen, to the House and Senate, you know, we're going to offer you some training if you'd like to come in.
Yep.
As a result of Senator's question dealing with the baseball shooting. And I think that, you know, that's a good thing, and that shows also the influence of the organization.
Absolutely. And I hope members of Congress, both sides of the aisle, take advantage of that that offer and that opportunity. And, you know, it's a fascinating survey, Paul. One of the other things that I thought was interesting, 67% of gun owners, you say, note that self-defense, that's the primary reason they own a gun. 38% say hunting, 30% sports shooting. If you're doing your math, that adds up to more than 100%. You could pick more than one answer. But
right.
but very clearly, you know, we hear all the time, well, you don't need X, Y, or Z for hunting. Okay. You might not, but there are a lot of Americans who are gun owners, not because they're hunters, but because they want to protect themselves and the people that they love.
Listen, a lot of gun stores have told me they've seen a spike in the past couple of years due to terrorism, due to just general threats they see in the newspapers and on TV. There's been a spike in especially buying pistols. And this is not just, you know, the usual white guy crowd. A ton of women are getting involved. A lot of minorities, especially African Americans, are buying these guns. And the reason is for self-protection. Yeah, they go to the range. About 30% say they like to do that. 30% say they like to hunt. But generally, it's self-protection, and that has also, of course, sparked, you know, the concealed carry movement. And in Congress, it looks like they almost have enough votes, certainly in the House, to push through the concealed carry reciprocity law.
I think we're over 200 sponsors now on concealed carry reciprocity. And, you know, concealed carry, they didn't ask specifically about concealed carry, but this Pew survey noted, I think, what 26% of gun owners, they said, responded that they are usually carrying a firearm for self-defense. That number went up to 41% of gun owners who live in neighborhoods that they feel are unsafe. And I wish that they had asked 101st question, Paul, because I would have loved to have known, among the gun owners in particular, are you able to legally carry, even if you live, right? I mean, because we know that there are huge population centers like New York City, Washington, D.C., coastal California, Maryland, you're not going to be able to, New Jersey, you're not going to be able to get a concealed carry license. So I want to know, and I would love to know, how many of those gun owners would like to be able to carry but can't because of the laws of the state that they live in.
Yeah, I suspect that'll be a follow-up because that's kind of what Pew does. In fact, they might have asked it, and then we're going to get that in a month. But I think that's a good question. And they did ask, okay, for gun owners, do you have one close at hand? Is it loaded? Are you ready to go if something is ready to happen? And 38% said yes, they are ready.
That's, you know, and that doesn't surprise me either because I think, again, over the past few years, the number of new gun owners coming in, they're not interested in just buying a gun and putting it up on a shelf somewhere. Like, they want to get trained. They want to go to the range. They're very much thinking about this. And this was not a, I don't think for many of these folks, this was a quick decision. I think a lot of folks have thought about this for some time. So the fact that, you know, if they're carrying a firearm or if they have a firearm for self-defense, the fact that it's ready to be used in case they need it, that doesn't surprise me at all. What about you?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, I live in Northern Virginia, and I belong to a couple of shooting clubs like Isaac Walton, and we've seen a spike in the number of people who were going there, who were training, who were taking classes. There's a really nice range here, Silver Eagle, and you have to wait in line to go through there. Carry classes. So people are very tuned in, and a lot of it is due to, you know, yeah, somewhat the terrorism that they see around the world, but, you know, the other things like the baseball shooting or yeah. What happened up in up north with that terrorist attack. They're just much more aware of their surroundings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Paul, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. We'll have to do an interview out at the NRA range one day. Would you do that with us?
I'm there.
All right, man. We'll make that happen at some point in the very near future. Always good talk with you, Paul.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Paul Bedard, at Secrets Bedard on Twitter, WashingtonExaminer.com. A guy who has been around, again, the Washington Whispers, the secrets that Paul Bedard has learned over the years, because he's been in the D.C. area covering politics for a long, long time. I would love to know the stuff that he can't talk about. Maybe we'll try to get him to give us a couple of secrets if we do something out at the NRA range. Meanwhile, speaking of the NRA range and the NRA offering that training to members of Congress and their staff, comes at a really good time. I mean, not just the shooting in Alexandria last week, but Columbus Dispatch reporting. A voicemail that threatened U.S. Representative Steve Stivers and his family landed a Westerville, Ohio man in federal court on Wednesday, charged with a crime that carries a 10-year prison term if he's convicted. In a voicemail, an authority said was left with the Republicans' Hilliard District office on Sunday. The caller mentioned the June 14th baseball practice, during which Steve Scalise and four others were wounded or injured. The message stated, according to a criminal complaint filed by Capitol Police in U.S. District Court in Columbus, quote, "I've seen the prayer y'all were saying at the baseball diamond. I think y'all better hit your knees and pray for the people that you're screwing up their lives. We're coming to get every bleeping one of you and your families. Maybe the next one taken down will be your daughter, huh? Or your wife, or even you." Yeah. 68-year-old E. Stanley Hoff has been charged with threatening to assault, kidnap, or murder a United States official. He appeared in federal court wearing a Mickey Mouse T-shirt, jeans, and sandals, in addition to ankle and wrist chains. According to the complaint, Hoff has left at least 5 threatening voicemails at the Hilliard office of Representative Stivers since February. Capitol Police actually got in contact with the guy, told him stop. He didn't. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kevin Kelly told Chief Magistrate Elizabeth Preston Devers that Hoff is a, quote, significant danger to the community. He said, "We had to take it seriously, especially when he mentioned the baseball game." Well, they are taking it seriously. The magistrate has ordered this guy held without bail. He's not getting out. They're treating this very seriously. At PJ Media, Paula Bolliard says that there's still some objections to the idea of members of Congress even having more security, much less being able to protect themselves. Representative Marcia Fudge from Ohio, when asked whether it would be a good idea for members of Congress to carry concealed in Washington, D.C., said no, more guns are not the answer. Well, you know, look, we talked about this yesterday. I'm a firm believer that every law-abiding American has the right to carry in Washington, D.C., even though the law currently does not allow that. I don't really believe in special privileges for elected officials when we're talking about a constitutional right that should be available to all. But, I think every law-abiding American should be able to carry in Washington, D.C. Specifically when it comes to these members of Congress, again, you got a lot of them who live in Northern Virginia, but they travel into the district to work. A lot of members who, a lot of people who work in Washington, D.C. who are not members of Congress, who don't work on Capitol Hill, go through the same thing. They can't carry on their way to, can't carry on their way from. Can't carry, if you were at a place, an early morning event in Northern Virginia, you're headed to the office afterwards, can't do it. And, you know, again, we're talking about that constitutional right to keep and bear arms that should mean something. Should mean, but it doesn't. Not in the District of Columbia. Again, if Representative Fudge says more guns are not the answer, that begs the question. I'm sure she would say that fewer guns are the answer. Not fewer guns in the hands of, you know, Capitol Police or members of Congress, perhaps. But what is the answer then? And by the way, I don't know if Representative Fudge is a member of the quote-unquote Common Sense Gun Safety Coalition. But we just heard from Every Town for Gun Safety that they support the Second Amendment. They're not trying to take anybody's guns away. Right? They're just in favor of a few common sense regulations. Okay. Well, again, tell me the common sense here. Tell me the common sense. If you've got somebody who is a concealed carry holder in Northern Virginia, they can legally carry in Alexandria, they can legally carry in Arlington, but they can't cross the Potomac River and carry in Washington, D.C. Why? Where's the common sense there? They're responsible in Virginia, right? But they're going to be irresponsible if they get into the district? I don't get that. I don't understand the quote-unquote common sense part of that position. Anyway, we'll keep our eyes on this continued issue. And again, with over 200 sponsors now for National Right to Carry Reciprocity, I mean, we're getting really close to having the support needed in the House. 217 votes. That's what you need. We got over 200 sponsors right now. Make sure that your lawmakers have heard from you. And again, tell all of your friends who are NRA members or even those who think that they're NRA members, tell them to call their Congress critters as well, because the more support that this gets from us, then the more support it's going to get in Congress. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will join us. His latest column, Spare Me the Principal's Lecture. I imagine Kurt, he likes delivering those lectures. He doesn't like being on the receiving end. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more Cam and Company right after this.
Here at SHOT Show, Kellyanne Pidgeon of Armed and Feminine. So, obviously, there's so much to talk about with women and guns and women shooting. Where are we right now? We're talking about 2017. We're talking about being at a show with so much representation of women, so many women here. This is such a burgeoning industry in general, but for women, it's huge right now.
Loving it. We still see male-dominated, especially here. I was coming over. I said, now I know what the salmon feel like, you know, swimming upstream. And that's sort of what the women's movement has been like until recently. You know, we've been the salmon swimming upstream, but we've really begun to be embraced by a lot of the manufacturers now, and it had been a struggle for a long time, and we're just a soaring force, and we have so many wonderful ladies organizations right now that are promoting that. And what's even nicer is that, like I said, the manufacturers are responding to us just in terms of holsters that fit us, guns that are lighter weight, things that just better fit our bodies, education for women, which is really, really big from a lot of the organizations that I deal with, a lot of education and empowerment for women. So we're on the move, and we're here to stay, and it's It's a wonderful thing.
Well, you say you're here to stay, but, you know, let's be honest. We know that women drive shopping decisions. We know women drive household decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Women, they pick where you're going to go on vacation, you know.
Pretty much.
So you guys, you control a lot of the spending dollars.
And the checkbooks.
It's where you go, everything else goes, correct?
Yeah. And actually, last year, I think I said to John, too, you know, what the mom and the matriarch and the family believe, so will her children. And so the more women that we get involved in believing this, her children will just, you know, through osmosis growing up, mm-hmm. are going to learn that and respect all of that and continue all of this. And so when we say women will save the Second Amendment, that's why, not just the checkbook, but what mama believes the rest of the family will do too.
All right, so you talked about the manufacturers, and of course you're here and meeting with everybody.
Right.
Some of the women we talk to in this industry, they complain about the shrink it and pink it factor, where they all they do is make it smaller for your hands, and they slap pink on it. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I love pink.
Controversy.
I love pink, but all of my guns are black or the sand color. I own no pink guns. I would have to agree. There were some fellas here that I met with last year, and I loved their holsters. Their concept was fantastic. And I said to him, look, you need to move this clip a little bit because we have different pants, hip bones. And so he actually got from the third floor to the second floor, first floor this year. And I said, hey, did you move it? And no, he didn't. So I'm like, did you forget about me? So he's actually making one specifically for me with some ideas that I gave him, and my other girlfriend was with me too, and we're like, this is what we have. He's like, all right, I'm going to make that now. But right, shrink it and
pink it.
Shrink it and pink it is not necessarily where we are.
Right.
When we look at women, we have so many different body types, heights, widths, you know, curves. They almost need a whole specific line, mm-hmm. you know, to do that. So step by step, we're getting there. I have found a lot more product out on the floors this SHOT Show rather than last that is a lot more tailored mm-hmm. to our needs and really enjoying it.
Yeah.
Really enjoying
when you
it.
Talk about getting women involved, you know, they come mm-hmm. to you first, say, hey, what do I do? You know, elevator speech, how should women get involved in the shooting sports?
Find a trainer. I train women from, you know, 18 years old. I think my oldest has been 80. I actually did one class where 10 women, the youngest one was 64 years old, to 80. Yeah, and it was one of the most fun classes that we ever had. They want to learn. They want to do it correctly. They want to be safe. Mm-hmm. The first thing they want to do is be safe. And we always going to say, you know, don't go to Uncle Buck up camp to teach you. Find somebody who is trained, find a trainer, and learn it, because we need to touch things. Like, what is this called? What does it do? How does it work? Where are the directions? And Uncle Buck doesn't always teach those kinds of things. Right. And safety is always on the minds and the forefront of women. So certainly find a trainer. You know, a lot of the organizations have them right online. Even when we go to NRA.org, and we can find a class, and you can look specifically if you want a woman. Mm-hmm. A lot of women, what I've learned, feel better or more comfortable, less intimidated with female instructors mm-hmm. because they feel like they're not going to get shut down or look stupid.
It's
I'm not going to look
gym
stupid.
Effect.
Exactly.
Yeah, the same thing there.
Exactly.
You know, women only gyms.
Right. And actually, I'm starting into my third season, and I only did it very, very part-time the first season. I doubled the number of women that I trained the second season, and I'm going to double that again this year. I just, like, can't even keep up, which is a wonderful thing because we're starting that. Well, it's a grassroots movement. You know, do this all locally, and we find that they just can't get enough of it, and they want more training, and they want to do everything correctly. I actually have two students who are going to NRA instructor training this coming weekend.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Join us on the program right now, senior columnist at Town Hall, president of the New Order Fan Club, Los Angeles chapter. It is Mr. Kurt Schlichter. Kurt, how are you, sir?
I'm kicking it old school.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Spare me the principles.
Only school I attend.
There is a little of the School of Hard Knocks, right?
Well, yeah.
A little bit of
just
that.
Just a little. I do most of the knocking.
I was going to say, the title of your column, Spare Me the Principles Lecture, you are the type who I think likes to deliver the lectures, not be on the receiving end.
Yeah, I'm not so much about them talking at me anymore.
No, not no. So what lecture Do you want to be spared? What lecture do you think is going around right now, the principal's lecture?
There's a lot of guys who, and some of them make good points. I'm not talking about everybody. A guy like Ben Shapiro makes very important points. You should listen to him, though he doesn't agree with me. And then there's some other guys, some guys who are really, really concerned that conservatism has been invaded by, you know, them regular people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them didn't go to Harvard. And, you know, they don't even know who I am. You know, I never. And there's a lot of them who are upset that people are angry. And we should be more refined and not interrupt their cocktail party and, you know, not make waves and just kind of take what we're given by our betters. And I'm tired of it. I'm tired of these guys going, you know, conservative principle obligates you to allow Hillary Clinton to be made president. How could you how could you not see that? Oh, I never. They're like a boring Elihu Smales.
You specifically zone in on the disrupting of the Julius Caesar play in Central Park,
I mean, you know, a couple guys get up and they start shouting, "Stop shooting us." Then they do some kind of things that are kind of like lame. But, you know, these guys are, you know, these liberals are sitting there watching this murder fest, gleefully squealing as Donald Trump, wink, wink, is being butchered on stage. And, of course, I'll tell you, don't you understand? It's literature. Yeah, right. And, you know, these guys interrupt it for about 5 seconds to confront these guys with the fact that they're, you know, dirtbags, clapping like seals for murder, especially after, you know, Steve Scalise was shot by, you know, the liberal Democrat the other day. Although the FBI can't seem to find a reason. Maybe if he yelled Allah Akbar, they'd have thought it was workplace violence.
Yeah. You want to talk about that for a second? Because I'm
sure.
I'm curious.
What the hell? I mean, really, who's the guy who gets up there with a straight face and goes, you know, his videotape testimony where he said, "I am shooting them because they are Republicans. I hate Republicans. I love Democrats, and I want to kill Republicans." I see a lot, you know, who can know? Really, what's inside? I mean, it's just like, shut up. God, you know, if you're going to lie to me, I'm a lawyer, so I expect a little, you know, effectiveness. I expect you to show some skill, demonstrate some flair.
Well,
I mean, these guys aren't even good at it.
Help me out with this one, because I'm giving too much benefit of the doubt here. But why wasn't this considered an act of terrorism? Is it because this guy he wasn't a part of a terrorist group, that there was no like terrorist ideology that he was following, that he was just inspired to commit? Like, I don't understand that, because to me, this was an act that was meant to inspire terror.
I think hack bureaucrats don't want to use that word because it's going to have even more of an effect on the political dynamic in a way that they don't particularly support. Now, most law enforcement people or law and order types who are pretty conservative folks, once you start getting into the command ranks, and that includes at the FBI, they become, like all other bureaucrats, a bunch of time-serving liberal hacks. And that's, you know, and I think there is a tremendous pressure not to embarrass the Democratic Party by saying what is an obvious truth, which is this was a liberal Democrat inflamed by, you know, tales of the resistance and the kind of hate that we see directed at normal Americans, who decided he was going to, however ineptly, try and kill a bunch of Republicans. Now, the fact that this guy was a blithering moron with no tactical proficiency, thank God, and the heroic efforts of the police officers who were on site, since the, you know, congressmen were disarmed because they can't keep and bear arms in Washington, D.C., and therefore didn't have them with them, thankfully they kept it from being a massacre. But that's what this guy intended. And, you know, it doesn't help to lie at us so poorly. That's why you got Trump.
There's a lot of that.
Can't just lie to our face and not get Trump or something else.
Well, there's a lot of that going around, I think, the lying to our faces in the hopes that we'll believe it. And if we don't, meh, what other choice do you have, right?
Yeah, the thing is, it doesn't, you know, it's like this weird kabuki dance where everybody knows the truth. It's like that poor girl who was a Muslim who was murdered, and it was, you know, and you know, liberals were gleeful. Finally, we found a Muslim being murdered. It turns out it's an illegal alien in a road rage incident.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that disappears off the front page. By the way, when's the last time you read about Scalise on the front page?
Oh, you haven't. I mean, it was.
You still see Gabby Giffords come along and. You know, every once in a while you get a profile of her and, you know.
Well, we were just talking about this in the last segment. You probably haven't even heard of this story, Kurt, but there's a guy who's been charged in federal court with threatening to kill a U.S. official, Congressman Steve Stivers from Ohio. This guy left a voicemail message last week after being warned by the Capitol Police previously, quit calling and leaving threatening messages. They tried to let him off with a warning. This guy calls back and says, yeah, you know, you guys were all praying at that baseball practice. Well, you better get on your knees now because we're going to kill every bleeping one of you. How'd you feel if it was your daughter or your wife or you? This guy's now facing 10 years in federal prison. He's been declared a threat to the community. He's being held without bail. Like, that's a big freaking follow-up story to the if we want to have the civility lecture, Kurt. Again, I think here's a fairly important update that I think the national media has completely ignored.
Yeah, but Russians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, have you noticed that's actually kind of gone away?
I have noticed that's actually kind of gone away, yes.
Yeah, they're kind of like, you know, didn't work in Georgia.
Right? In fact, I think it was... I think it was Chris Murphy from Connecticut. Now, he's probably telling him, let's talk about gun control again. But I think he said something like, you know, we just can't keep talking about this. And he's right, by the way. I think, you know, everybody watching this has concluded there's really no there. This is a continuing distraction. It's not going to get Democrats anywhere, quite frankly. And I think, Kurt, the longer that they do this, the Democrats run the risk of becoming a punchline, quite frankly.
Absolutely. They, but don't tell them.
No. Well,
you know, let Chris Murphy keep, you know, telling his impoverished Connecticut constituents who can't balance their own budget, you know, we need to take away all the guns from all the normal Americans, and we'll keep telling the normal Americans. Let Nancy Pelosi say, I want to make all of America like San Francisco. Which one comic memorably described as a city that makes its own gravy.
A city that makes its own gravy?
Yeah. If you live there and walk through it,
mm-hmm.
you'll know what you mean.
Okay.
You'll know what I mean.
All right. I will take your word for it. Do you see, Kurt, I mean, is there any hope on the horizon that you've seen in terms of, you know, actually getting people to quit talking past one another and to actually start to deal with the fact that, all right, you don't like the way Republicans are acting. Republicans, you don't like the way the left is acting. Hey, how about we back away a little bit from what we're doing? Is there any hope of that happening?
I don't know. But you know what? I'm kind of at a you first place.
Yeah.
You know, eventually, you know, you're sitting at a bar, you're enjoying a beer, and somebody keeps, like, messing with you. And it's like, dude, just leave me alone. Dude, just chill. Dude, get out of my face. Finally, you go, okay. You stand up, and now the guy's like, hey, man, I'm just kidding. And you're like, well, you know, I stood up, so, you know, something's got to occur. Either you're gonna completely, you know, you're going to give up, or we're gonna see how this ends. I'm tired of it. I'm not going to be pushed around by these people. And I don't, and getting back to my article, I don't recognize any principle that requires that I lose. I'm not the bad guy. I'm the good guy. My side should win. I support freedom. I support the Constitution. And any principle that requires those things not prevailing, well, you can have that principle and you can go, you know, you can go observe it. It's not one of mine.
Talking again with Mr. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, the author of Indian Country, which was released, June the 1st? Is that right? It's been out for 3 weeks
now? Yeah, about the 29th, 28th. It's been out about 3 weeks, and it's doing fantastically. Indian Country's, you know, a lot of people are getting it, and, you know, it's getting a very good reaction. A lot of people expected a lot more, you know, erotic action.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, Kurt writes erotica. That would be the worst thing that ever happened.
I don't know. Part of me is like, well, maybe I'd buy it as a joke. But then like, oh, geez. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, there's probably a market for that, Kurt. There probably
is. Probably, well, you know, Kurt Eichenwald.
Just make sure you put some, like, what would that be, like octopus tentacles and stuff like
that. Oh, jeez. Yeah, Mr. Calamari. Oh, man.
That's Admiral Akbar to you.
Worst day ever to be named Kurt. Hear what Kurt said? Guys, you need to be more specific.
Hey, listen, buddy, we are almost out of time, but thank you, as always, for coming on the program. It is fantastic talking with you today. And, yes, we'll do it again very soon.
Sounds great.
All right, man. Kurt Schlichter, join us on the program at Kurt Schlichter on the Twitters. Just a couple of minutes left here on this edition of Cam and Company, but we'll give you a little bit of a sneak peek at what we're working on tomorrow. A record set, apparently, for the longest confirmed kill by a sniper, 2.2 miles between the Canadian sniper and his ISIS target in Iraq. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Also on tomorrow's program, we'll be checking with our friend Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Frank Miniter, writing at America's First Freedom, says the Washington Post bashing guns with bogus facts. What? Come on. Washington Post? Bogus facts in order to advance an anti-gun agenda? That's absolutely not crazy talk, unfortunately. That is par for the course. A editorial by the Washington Post blaming the NRA, blaming the Second Amendment for the deaths of nearly 1,300 children per year. No mention about the numbers going down, even as the number of gun owners goes up. Again, and there's no real a solution offered by the Washington Post. It is just another opportunity. Study comes out. Washington Post says, aha, how can we use this to attack the NRA? Well, they figured out their way, but Frank's got a rebuttal. He'll join us tomorrow to talk about it. All of the day's top Second Amendment news and information as well. We'll see you live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on SiriusXM Patriot 125, and on demand all the time at iHeartRadio, iTunes, and more. And safe, have fun. We'll talk to you soon with more Cam and Company.